OTB AM. This is OTB Sports Radio.
Yeah, you're very welcome along to OTB AM this Thursday morning. Big breaking news overnight from the Rugby World Cup. Two games have been cancelled and will be nil-all draws in the record books. The Italy-New Zealand game, which is due to be a couple of Italian players' final games, and who knows, maybe Conor Shea's last game as well, will now be in the record books as a nil-all draw. The England-France game will also be a nil-all draw, with massive repercussions for that French squad, who you felt like they kind of needed to get out there and let off a bit of steam after all the stuff that had been going on in the background there. So they're both through to the quarterfinals, and it doesn't really have any material impact. It looks like it's going to be Wales versus France and England versus Australia. So, you know, maybe England would have preferred to lose that game. Who knows? We'll wait and see. The big news, obviously, that we're interested in is what the hell's going to happen with the Japan game. As it stands, the Japan-Scotland game will take place, but a decision will be made about 6 hours before kickoff in that game on Sunday, when they wait and see what damage has been done by Typhoon Hagibis, and they make a decision at that point to see whether or not that game can go ahead. The ramifications are fairly clear at this point. If Ireland get a bonus point win on Saturday, then a nil-all draw would still leave Japan on top of the group, because you get 2 points, obviously, for a draw, which means that we will be playing a very well-rested All Blacks in the quarterfinal the following weekend on the Saturday, I think that game will be. If that game goes ahead, then all bets are off. We have to pray that Scotland win, and we might have a chance still of playing the Springboks. But anyway, let's hear from the man who's in charge of the Rugby World Cup. It's World Rugby's Alan Gilpin. Here's how he made the announcement today.
After extensive evaluation of the latest detailed weather information, we are today confirming adjustments to this weekend's Rugby World Cup 2019 match schedule as a result of the predicted significant impact of Typhoon Hagibis. This includes, regrettably, the decision to cancel matches on safety grounds. Based on this morning's information from our independent weather experts, Hagibis is predicted to be the biggest typhoon of the 2019 season and is highly likely to cause considerable disruption in the Tokyo, Yokohama and City of Toyota areas throughout Saturday, including likely public transport shutdown and disruption. As a result of the detailed independent advice from the weather advisers, and given the scheduled public transport closures, we've taken the very difficult but we think right decision to cancel certain matches in the affected areas. As we briefed you before the tournament, for pool matches that do not go ahead as scheduled, these matches are cancelled and 2 points will be awarded to each team in line with tournament rules. Based on the latest detailed weather information we have, we can provide the following update. For tomorrow, Friday the 11th of October, the Pool D match scheduled between Australia and Georgia in Shizuoka, we expect to be played as scheduled. For Saturday the 12th of October, the Pool A match between Ireland and Samoa in Fukuoka, we expect to be played as scheduled. The Pool B match between New Zealand and Italy in the City of Toyota will be cancelled. The Pool C match between England and France at Yokohama Stadium will be cancelled. As you can imagine, the decision to cancel these matches has not been taken lightly and has been made with the best interests of team, public, tournament and volunteer safety as a priority, based on the expert advice and the detailed information we have available.
Owen Sheehan, good morning to you. This is devastating news from the Rugby World Cup organisers' perspective, because it really makes a mockery of the decision to go to Japan in the first place. But at the same time, they've got to get on with it now. So what is the general assessment from your colleagues in the Rugby Press Corps about where this leaves the tournament now?
Yeah, it's a bit of a disaster, isn't it? It's complete chaos. And as the Scots might tell us in about 40 minutes, it's a bit of a farce, to be quite honest with you. They're due to do a press conference in and around Yokohama at 4 o'clock this local time, which is 8 o'clock back home, the same time as the Ireland team is announced. This press conference was not scheduled. Privately, the Scottish are said to be fuming with this. They weren't too happy with how they exited the last World Cup, so you can imagine they'd be absolutely livid if they exit the World Cup in these circumstances. Now, they do accept, I presume, that the safety for actual humans on the ground here is the most important thing. That is the primary concern. And we've got a massive stadium in Yokohama here with the responsibility for around 70,000 people. So that has to be number one. What they won't be happy with is the lack of a contingency plan, because, as you say, it may make a mockery of coming to Japan in the first place. But if you are coming to Japan, where is your plan B? If there was to be a typhoon in any situation, where does a game get moved? You would have thought that there would have been a typhoon safety net for every single game in this year's tournament. If this game gets cancelled on Sunday, you'd imagine that that is not the case. Like, Scotland at this point would take, refund all the fans, move the game down to Fukuoka here, even give the team an extra 24 hours to travel, move the game up to Sapporo or somewhere. Big country. This place here in Fukuoka is not going to get hit too badly by the storm. It'll be windy for the Ireland game on Saturday, but this could definitely host another game or one of the other stadiums around this part of the country. So the Scots are not going to be happy.
Yeah, I think that's the key point here. That maybe there is a contingency plan for this fixture, but they said that it's either a go-no-go situation at the moment. Am I correct in that? Because that was a little bit unclear in how this was announced. Those two games are obviously off. There's no contingency plan for those. And in fairness, they're games you can afford to lose in many respects, because the quarterfinal pairings aren't going to be significantly impacted from England and France's perspective. It doesn't really matter who they're facing in the next round. They would both fancy their chances against whoever they're getting from the Wales-Australia group. But this obviously is going to have a material impact on whether or not the host nation goes through and whether or not Scotland are left fighting. There are no contingency plans for this fixture. Is that correct?
Correct. Nothing that was announced today. They said that they will make a decision 12 hours before the game, it seems, on Sunday morning. So there seems to be a sense that quite confident that things could be okay come Sunday. This is going to batter the country on Saturday. Even looking at what transport organizations have been saying, I personally got a flight with ANA booked for Sunday morning back up to Tokyo. The airline have been in touch to say that there's a high likelihood that flights on Saturday will be cancelled. No mention at all of what's going to happen on the Sunday. And it seems that Rugby World Cup have taken a similar stance. They think it could be okay come Sunday. If I was in charge of World Rugby, I'd personally be thinking of a contingency plan. What if this storm does last for another 12 hours? What if, for example, there's damage done to the area around Yokohama Stadium with the horrific conditions that come on Saturday? Will there be time to have the outside the stadium area in a fully working condition when it comes to health and safety regulations in the immediate aftermath of a super typhoon? I'm not so sure there is. Like, it's not just a matter of fact of showing up on the day and playing the game. There are so many other things that World Rugby need to think about when it comes to this, when it comes to the safety of the people attending this match. And I do think it would have just been a safer and a better option to just say, listen, we will refund your tickets and we are so sorry about this, but we have to move this game south. We cannot allow this game to be under threat because it is such a huge game for both teams involved.
Yeah, we've just shown some footage there of that you actually posted on your Twitter account of the last super typhoon that was there. I think even the footage that we're seeing is from a typhoon that was a lower category than the one that's about to make landfall. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think that was from Richard Freeman's Twitter timeline. He quote-tweeted somebody from a typhoon that was in Osaka last year, and that was one of the worst ones they had last year. This one this year is going to be the worst we've had in 2019, the worst so far. And I guess when you look at some of the language that's been used around it, like kind of like a violent typhoon and things like that, it is kind of scary a little bit. The escalation has been unlike anything weather meteorologists have seen in history. The level of escalation over the past 72 hours or so, this thing has become massive. Like, the eye of the storm isn't huge in comparison to how it could be, but whatever this storm is going to go through, it does seem it's going to cause absolute and utter chaos.
The one last year was 400 kilometres in diameter. The one at the moment, Hagibis or Hagibis, depending on you pay your money, it takes your choice on the pronunciation of it at the moment, is 1,400 kilometres in diameter. Is there any danger that this has an impact on quarterfinals?
Like, that, this is the thing that I've been talking about. It's like, it's not just on the day. What is the lasting damage of this? Like, we got into Chiba, we got into Tokyo area a week after a typhoon, and there was still some impact on the train, and there was a lack of train services a couple of the days that I was going out to Chiba. So it's a long-lasting thing, a typhoon like this. This is going to be way worse than the typhoon that they experienced before the tournament. So there will, of course, be damage done, you'd imagine, to rail services, to perhaps roads here. You just don't know what's going to happen. It's complete random, really. So yeah, I would say that it does have to surely be taken into consideration. There have been some rumours, and I will stress it's just rumours, that all four quarterfinals get moved to Oita And now two of the quarterfinals are penciled in for there next weekend, and the other two are penciled in for Tokyo Stadium. But it might be not the worst move in the world if they were to start moving other games towards Ōita, because this part of the country, this island, is not going to be too badly affected.
Where's Ōita?
Ōita is where I was yesterday for Wales against Fiji. It's about 2 hours south of Fukuoka. It's on this island of Kyushu. So it's in the south, closer to South Korea than it would be to Tokyo. And it seems that this was a place that was going to be pretty badly affected at the start of the week. It was more going to be towards Kobe. And then the storm was actually made more of an arc than we expected, and it's heading towards Tokyo. I've been looking at kind of maps myself. There are some varying degrees of magnitude of this. Like, how could this play into Ireland on Saturday? Like, is it going to be an extremely gusty day? Like, there's no roof in the stadium in Fukuoka. And it does seem now that most of the maps have actually kind of narrowed a little bit to the point where this place is going to be completely free from the effects of a typhoon. Maybe some gales here and there, but it should be okay. But yeah, just back to the original point, I wouldn't be surprised if there was some consideration done as to those two quarterfinals next weekend, one Saturday, one Sunday in Tokyo.
Oh, and obviously the big story in world rugby was that situation overnight. The big story in Irish rugby was the size of your swollen hand after you got bitten by a mosquito. What the hell happened?
I don't know what happened, to be quite honest with you, Chair. I was sitting here chatting to you 24 hours ago after relaxing in an onsen for the afternoon. I wondered, did the onsen water perhaps flare up by mosquito bite? I'm not so sure about that. Like, it could have been sunburn as well. Can sunburn make a mosquito bite worse? I got a bit of a roasting yesterday. I'll show you my two hands now. I think they've gone down.
Yeah, they've mostly gone down, yeah. Although, it's your left hand. Definitely looks a bit bigger than normal.
Yeah, it definitely is still a bit. Like, you can barely see my knuckles at this point. But spent about 3 hours in various hospitals last night. Completely empty waiting rooms. But it was tough to actually try and get seen in the end. And eventually I do get seen. And 20 seconds later, he's like, just take some antihistamine.
That was it.
That was it, basically. Could have just got it over the counter.
Well, in fairness, that was exactly my advice.
Well, yeah, exactly. I would like to say a big shout out to Adrian Barry, who was playing the role of a trooper, really, back home in Ireland yesterday when I was trapped on a train from Ōita back up here to Fukuoka, trying to suss out if there's any doctors around that could have a look at me. So I'm trusting the doctor who gave me antihistamine, that he looked at it and was like, actually, this is going to be fine. And I'm feeling okay. Survive this war. It's okay. You can all take a deep breath, ladies and gentlemen.
Okay, there's a bunch of press conferences happening. The Scots are having one at 8 o'clock. Ireland are having one at 8 o'clock. We're naming our team. So we're going to let you go and get set up for that. But I think we pretty much know the team is going to be a very, very strong team. Sexton's going to start it out half, right?
Yeah, exactly. Sexton at out half. And they're going all guns blazing for this. Sandy Farrell said it earlier in the week, so it's going to be no surprise. They need to win this game. They need to win it with a bonus point. There are no excuses at this point. And to be honest with you, if you're looking at the landscape of things now, Ger, are we just in a case where we're like, screw it, we just have to grab nettle at this point and just go with it? There is going to be no resting up, because the All Blacks, who could be our likely opponents, are suddenly going to have an extra week. How can we turn that to our favour? Can a team who played the week before be the team that could potentially be rusty? That is the positive spin that Ireland will be putting on it. They managed to
That was rusty All Blacks. Give me some of that hot, hot, rusty All Black action. All right, Owen, thanks a million. Congratulations on fixing your hand, and great reporting on the big breaking news story overnight. So we'll talk to you real soon. Owen's heading off to bring us the Ireland press conference at 8 o'clock when the team is announced for our last pool game against Samoa. But I think we have a fair idea of what it's going to be. Coming up on OTBAM, here's what we've got for the rest of the show for you all the way until 9:30 this morning. Going to start with the Rugby World Cup cancellation. Obviously, that is the big breaking story. Two games have been called off. Sports page is coming your way in just 1 minute. It's 7:44 now, so we're bang on schedule, unusually so. The Irish Rugby Presser, 5 minutes past eight, is going to have Joe Schmidt. We've got Keith Wood's reaction to the Ireland team and also the news that two big games have been cancelled. A third is in danger, and the quarterfinals may yet be moved away from Tokyo in the aftermath of the typhoon. And Kieran McGean's going to join us in studio around about 8:35. We'll be back to Japan around about 9:05. More sports news with Phil, and Ireland under 21s against Italy. Yeah, John Duggan is here with us. John, good morning to you.
Hi, Ger, how are you?
I don't remember a situation like this.
Well, it's never happened that in 32 years of World Rugby Cups that there's been cancellations. It's unprecedented, and it's not great.
Like, the Italians have been...
Well, nobody's talking about the Italians. It's all about Scotland. Nobody's talking about Italy.
The Italians are obviously out, and they knew they were out. But there was somebody had ruptured an Achilles or something, and had come back.
Was it Giraldi? Or I think.
Yeah. So, do we have that tweet? We can get that for you there. It's Nick Simon says, in the chaos of the typhoon, spare thought for Italy. Giraldini was set for a 20-minute farewell cameo against New Zealand. The final rugby match of his 15-year career. He spent months rehabbing and broke down in tears when the news of the cancellation broke in training. So Sergio Parisse, presumably this was his last game as well.
Conor O'Shea?
Potentially. I mean, I think sometimes Conor O'Shea might stay, but like...
But even if they're going to go out with honour, you're building up psychologically to play the All Blacks at a World Cup, to play the All Blacks at a World Cup.
Yeah.
And if you're an England or a France fan, maybe spending thousands to go out there for maybe one pool game.
Yeah.
And then it's all gone.
I'm going to go for the last pool game, which will be the best one, which is England-France.
And I guarantee you in the small print, there'll be no like compensation or anything like that for that.
Absolutely not. And look, obviously the right thing to do is...
For the safety of people, look, it's only a game, but it is unfortunate.
But they knew that it was typhoon season.
Yeah.
So it's not like a typhoon makes landfall once every 20 years in Japan. Typhoons...
There's 26 of them off the coast of Japan and 2.6 on average hit a year.
Right. So they knew this was going to happen. And if it happens, if it's going to be here, we'll have plan B here. Yeah. If it hits here, we'll have plan B here. It's not the typhoon,
it's the contingencies.
Yeah. The notion that there's no contingency for group stages. They're saying that there are contingency for the quarterfinals, but they haven't announced what they are yet.
But we see like teams playing each other within days. Scotland are playing games within days of each other. So it's like, you know, it's not that they have to rest for 5 days. They can play games within 2 to 3 days. I don't know whether it's the broadcasters or the empty stadiums wasn't an appealing thing, I don't think, to move the England game.
But
just get the games played for the integrity of the sport.
Absolutely. Better an empty stadium than no game. So all a bit of a disaster really for the Rugby World Cup, kind of plunges the competition into chaos. Let's bring you through the newspapers. The back page of the Irish Independent. Two very interesting stories here. O'Leary eyes sponsor bid and new twist to Mayo dispute. Now this is... good work here from Donica Boyle, who seems to have seen an email to the Mayo County Board from the New York-based trader Tim O'Leary, who obviously has been a major backer of Mayo GAA in recent years. He emailed the county's commercial manager, Tom Riley, expressing interest in submitting a tender for the sponsorship package, which is the naming rights to McHale Park and also the sponsor on the county jerseys. The language of the email is very interesting. It's come to my attention that Mayo GAA are in the process of seeking submissions for commercial sponsorship of the various teams to include the senior team and the naming rights to McHale Park. Can I ask you to accept this letter as an expression of my interest in submitting a tender for the sponsorship package? Can I ask that you please forward me a copy of the tender documents along with your bid assessment process? I trust the county board will run a professional bid process with relevant governance structures in place. I look forward to hearing from you at your earliest convenience. So remember, he had written a very critical letter that was doing the rounds. The Irish Independent published it, saying that the foundation had ceased funding the county board until appropriate governance structures are put in place.
I think we're seeing with Galway as well that the game of sports governance has changed. Now, the FAI has obviously been a shining light in, you know, what shouldn't be done in recent times. I think that kind of culture of accountability is spreading into everything in our sport and regarding the spotlight and the media coverage of it. And I think, like even we saw with the cost of the Porky Queef. So I think that, can you centralise control a bit more into Croke Park? Would it be a good thing if that happened? Possibly. But these stories, I don't know if I'd seen them a year ago or 2 years ago.
Well, there's certainly, it doesn't seem like any particular Irish sport is capable of looking at other Irish sports and going, ha-ha, everybody's got a bit like, careful a bit about this. The other, obviously, your man wrote that letter, went public about the money that they had spent on the do in New York, etc., etc. And the contents of the letter were not dealt with at last month's county board meeting, but I hadn't known this at the time. Mayo GAA board treasurer Kevin O'Toole told delegates he intended to reply to the allegations at the October meeting, which takes place next Wednesday. So plenty of drama to be expected next Wednesday. He claimed that the foundation's letter contained a huge amount of misinformation. This is brilliant stuff. I will have a line-by-line reply in chronological order of the moving sands of the moving sands. Because there are more moving sands in the Mayo Foundation than there is in the Sahara.
And now it's in the papers.
Yeah, that's great.
And I think the thing is, letters can be written now and correspondence can be had, but it does get out.
Oh, yeah.
Stick
anything down in an email that you don't want published.
No, you don't. It's like rule 101 of life, isn't it, in business?
So they're saying Henshaw's getting his chance. So Robbie Henshaw's going to play. The team, as expected to be named, is Tadhg Byrne in the back row alongside Josh van der Fleer and CJ Stander, which is interesting because it means it's the front five, first choice, Healy, Best, Furlong, Henderson and James Ryan. It's Murray and Sexton. Wings are Stockdale and Earls, Bundy, Aki and Robbie Henshaw and Jordan Larmour instead of Rob Kearney, who's nursing an injury. So, yeah, it'll be announced probably at 8.
But yeah.
That was the team that everybody got leaked yesterday. So,
it's Kearney, O'Mahony and Ringrose all just being rested. Look, we'll get the bonus point. There's nothing to worry about. It's more, the worry I have more so is that New Zealand and South Africa have a much bigger rest going into the quarterfinal.
Yeah. And certainly South Africa, at least New Zealand had a game, at least South Africa had a game, New Zealand don't.
Yeah, so I'm a bit worried about the, from a preparation point of view, how much we'll be in the backseat to the Southern Hemisphere nations, whoever we play.
The Daily Mirror, the back page. Duff at the top. This is some great news coming through in the last 24 hours. Talismanic defender Shane, fit and ready to go for key battle as Irish fight to remain at summit. If he's fit and he's playing, that's heroic stuff to recover from injury in time for these games.
And he's trained this week. No Enda Stevens because he's banned, and no Richard Keogh because of other issues, as we know about. So if he's fit enough, he probably will be in there. McGoldrick didn't go to Georgia. But he could be in line to play against Switzerland on Tuesday. But yeah, it's Shane Duffy's a leader, and he's also great at set pieces.
Yeah, so, it's like one of our best opportunities to score. Yeah,
so. Exactly.
The Star. Health scare for Matt Doherty has revealed he enjoyed a recent skin cancer scare before receiving the all clear on a growth on his lower lip. Stalemate in Clare, that was the other story coming through last night. Clare GAA is facing further turmoil after officials failed to ratify a new hurling manager at a county board meeting in Clare Abbey last night. So Brian Lowen, it emerged that Daylo was going to be part of his backroom team.
He usually would be the other way around, possibly, if you're looking at the days gone your, but I don't think the players are happy with the Donald Maloney situation, that there was a bit of delay and he withdrew. Maybe they might have wanted him to stay on. There's a kind of a, Louis McQueen, ticket with Fergal Lynch, I think, and Brendan Bugler might be kind of mooted behind that ticket. And then there's a kind of a low and day low ticket. So
all of these tickets would be good tickets, right?
Yeah, they would be.
They just need to make a call.
But they also need to sort their house out because Clare have underperformed since winning that All-Ireland in 2013. The three under-21s, there's actually four under-21s if you go back to 2009. They didn't see the best of those young players.
No.
And also Paul Kinnerk leaving to go to Limerick was a huge blow for Clare. The biggest setback that Clare hurling had in the last few years was Paul Kinnerk going to John Kiley at Limerick.
Yeah,
we saw his coaching now. But just get it sorted and get a plan in place because Clare have underperformed. Like, they nearly were in the All-Ireland final last year, but it's been two stop start.
Yeah, okay. So the back page of The Guardian is obviously a picture of the typhoon. World Cup in chaos as violent typhoon homes in on Yokohama. So that was before the news had come through that those games had been cancelled.
I was looking at Paul Hayward here this morning in the Telegraph. Tournament integrity depends on key match going ahead. That's all about the typhoon. And also in the English Times, cancellation would risk credibility of the tournament, an article by Owen Slot. They're pretty confident that Japan and Scotland will go ahead, either with the typhoon losing its teeth by Sunday night with a 7:45 local time kickoff in Yokohama on Sunday night, or moving it to Monday. But why would you be moving Scotland to Monday and not Italy?
I guess because the game doesn't matter, except for the integrity of the tournament and for everybody involved in Italian rugby. Murray and Sexton to equal record in fully loaded lineup, and then Ireland need to knuckle down for Samoa, says Furlong. So, it's a good strong team. It's shit or bust time for Ireland, and then the rest of that is just reports from yesterday's games where Wales had a bit of trouble with Fiji. Great picture of Shane Lowry there, who's been asked questions by social media and what he thought of the new management setup. They did a press conference at the Italian Open.
Italian Open, yeah.
He ended up being asked about Fenley, who named his backroom team. Actually, it looks like a good, decent backroom team as well.
Yeah, Racing Post has got Kavanagh says HRI will find a way to cater for extra demands. Efficiencies might be found following the government's decision not to increase authorities' funding for 2020. Too early to say what areas might be impacted, said Brian Kavanagh. So the allocation will remain at 80 million, 67.2 million goes to the horse racing industry. That's the horse and greyhound racing fund. Of course, the greyhound industry under much more pressure than the horse racing industry at the moment.
The Daily Mail, that one. Duffy Boost, key defender is available, but McGoldrick is out, and Ireland geared up for Georgia. So that is Colin Robinson in jovial form at Abbottstown yesterday. Mark Gallagher, the Irish gymnast, who's setting new standards, is Reese McLennan. And Henshaw chomping at the bit to play Samoa. So all we need is for Robbie Henshaw to come back and look like the old Robbie Henshaw, and for Johnny Sexton to be good again, and we'll all be able to have a week of believing that if the game goes ahead in the quarterfinals, Owen was suggesting it could be moved to the deep south of Japan. So let's wait and see what happens there.
Yeah, this is a very sad story. A true son of Down, Moran County, in the shock of the death of Eamon Burns. He's only in his mid-50s. That's terrible. Terribly sad, an All-Ireland winner in the 1990s. Duffy came in back at the Herald. Defender texted McCarthy to tell him he's fit. Do people still text? I thought they WhatsApped these days. Yeah.
Maybe Nick doesn't have WhatsApp. Who knows?
The Sun, priceless. Foden is the only player we'd ever sell, not even for 500 million. That's such a tabloid story. The back of the Sun. When the going gets tough, Duffy gets going. A bit of Billy Ocean for your morning on Off the Ball AM. Typhoon Clash, but Rob's out. That's Rob Carney we're talking about here on Off the Ball's newspaper slot.
Right, John, you got to go. Thanks very much for that. Matt Doherty was talking at yesterday's Irish football press conference. Here he is talking about his experience of playing left back.
I'm totally comfortable playing in that position. I've played two seasons there for Wolves, one and a half seasons maybe it was. It'll be nothing new to me. So if that is the case, then yeah, I'll enjoy it and grab the opportunity with both arms.
When did you actually last play left back?
Probably about 3 years ago. Probably before Nuno was the manager that season. Probably and at the start of that season, probably more than anything. So it has been a while, but I guess we're professional and I'll be able to adapt.
Is it very different?
Right, yeah, back. It is different. I know some people might think sometimes it's just right back, left back, it's just go over the other side, but positionally and things like that, there are differences. But like I said, we're professionals and I'm professional, so I should be able to be good enough to adapt pretty quickly.
Okay, so that was Matt Doherty yesterday talking about the differences between left back and right back. We're going to head over to the press conference in just a second, as soon as the Ireland management team sits down. There you go. They're not quite there just yet, but as soon as we see Joe Schmidt arrive to announce his team, I think it'll be confirmation of the team that's in the papers this morning, which we've been talking about. So a very, very strong team. Looks like Sexton is back alongside Conor Murray at 9 and 10. It's the first choice front five. Tadhg Byrne looks like he's going to get the nod at 6. Josh van der Fleer is going to be 7. CJ Stander is going to be 8. So an interesting team selection. There was some suggestion that maybe there was room for Rhys Ruddock to try and force his way into the starting team. That doesn't look like he's not going to have that opportunity ahead of Peter O'Mahony. So I guess that's good news for Peter O'Mahony that Tadhg Byrne is playing 6. Some comments for you. Do South Africa now top the group? They don't. I think we can stick up the group. Obviously, they were beaten, so New Zealand were 4 points ahead of them. New Zealand get 2 points for the draw. And irrespective of whether or not South Africa made up the gap by their bonus point win the last day, New Zealand still topped the group, so it would still be... Here's Ireland's group as it stands at the minute. Japan on 14. If they do have a nil-all draw with Scotland, that, of course, would give them 2 points, which would put them on 16, which means no matter what we do against Samoa, we can't top the group because, obviously, there would be 5 points for a win and they would beat us on head-to-head. Now, they're not obviously going to make that decision until after we play, so there'll be a little bit of jeopardy for Ireland. They'll still need to know that the bonus point win might give them the opportunity to top the group. There's the final Pool B standings, 3 wins and a draw for New Zealand. Can we go back to that last one? Sorry, just Pool B again. So Pool B is New Zealand on 16, South Africa on 15 and Italy on 12. Obviously, no one thought there was any chance of Italy beating New Zealand, but they did want to play that game. It was one of those games I presume that they had circled in the calendar from 2 years out. Okay, so on to Pool C. This is the final standings at the top of Pool C anyway. It's England on 17, France on 15. So 3 wins and a draw for England, 3 wins and a draw for France, 17, 15 on that one, and 11 for Argentina. So that last-minute drop goal that Argentina conceded against France is going to haunt them for a couple of years, no doubt. And then Pool D, this is Wales, Australia and Fiji. So Wales are on 14, Australia are on 11. And there's two games left in that, but you would automatically expect the situation there to be that Wales are going to top that group. So it's going to be Wales through to the semi-finals to face, Wales through to the quarter-finals to face France, and England are going to face Australia in the quarter-finals. Very well rested. So the press conference seems to have started. No. Yeah, okay. So we're going to get to them in a second. First, let's bring in some Ronan O'Gara. Here he is talking on last night's show about the need for the bench to make an impact, I think.
I think people underestimate, too, the impact of a quality bench and the fact that the drive or the lift that gives the players that are actually on the pitch when they have a look to the sideline, if there's a guy hurt or if there's a guy being replaced, actually who's coming on, and you kind of subconsciously go, oh, nice one. I like playing with this guy, or this guy's going to give a good... But that's the gut feeling of people that they never talk about. That's what happens. While if you have, for example, Robbie Henshaw, Chris Farrell, Joey Carberry not available, you're kind of having a look at the bench, and sometimes you're saying, oh, is he coming on? You know, because that's...
I'm going to have to cover from.
That's what players do. Maybe not even cover, but... What happens with Ireland and a lot of the best teams is that, or in any great thing, I think in great environments and great cultures, is that the people coming off the bench, their job isn't to take the role of the guy they've replaced. They've got to add something to the team and be better than the team. Be better than the guy they've replaced. It's not about filling in. So how you become better than actually the guy you're replacing is you fit into the team first and you do your basics well, but then against fatiguing defences, you've got to bring something to it. So it's not a case of being a passenger or a sheep. You've got to make sure that you are actually kicking on the team's performance, and it's expected of you in high performing teams.
Yeah. So sorry, we had planned to bring you the press conference from the Ireland management setup, but apparently there's some Wi-Fi problems, which we're blaming on the typhoon. That may or may not be actually what's happened, but certainly that's what we've been told anyway. So look, here's a bit more Ronan O'Gara for you. We're going to speak to Keith Wood in just a minute, but here he is talking about the Irish problems. Obviously, the question about 2007 keeps coming up.
In a year's time, we may well have players releasing books and be sitting down doing interviews going, geez, you know what? Actually, we were bloody wrecked when we got there. Something actually fundamentally has gone wrong in Ireland's build-up, that they're not at the level they should be right now.
No, I would be... I think there's a small percentage, but I would be... In the year 2019, I would be grossly shocked if that was the case. I just think this hasn't been something they've thought about in the last few months, Nathan. This has been, a project ever since Ireland lost to Argentina in the Millennium Stadium in 2015. You can see that everything has become Team Ireland in Ireland in the last 4 years. The fact that, you go back to my time playing the game, the Munster-Leinster games were juicy games. It was all on. Those games are off now. It's Team Ireland now. Everything is focused to get the best 30 players healthy, performing for Ireland. And I think there has been massive preparation, I would say, planning, focus, whatever the word is, for peaking for the month of October and the 2nd of November in Japan. I genuinely believe that. I would say that would be something that had been addressed in camp. I think there has been positive shoots in their game. Even in the last few weeks, you could look. Ireland never played the ball under the tackle prior to the Scottish game, and I think they did that really well in that game. I think if the game becomes so much easier when you win collisions, Ireland, even against the Japanese, they're powerful. Their footwork was exceptional, their speed at the ruck and their accuracy at the ruck. They won the collisions. So it looked like Ireland were kind of fatigued or exhausted. So you have to kind of, I think, give an awful lot of credit to the Japanese, and that's going to be such a great game to watch, the Japanese game and in the Scottish game, with so much at stake from a tactical point of view, how the opposing coaches are going to approach it. But coming back to your question, no, I think this is the fact that I think what Joe Schmidt and Andy Farrell and Simon Eastwood and Greg Feet bring to this, I think, is they bring great clarity. I think the boys will know their roles inside out. I think the improvement what they can make is their potential to probably see events unfold in front of their own eyes and play a little bit more instinctively, and I think that could be a winning formula for them.
Okay, well, all will be revealed, obviously. The Ireland game, as it stands, is definitely going to go ahead. Kick off at 11:45 Irish time on Saturday morning. It's Ireland versus Samoa in Fukuoka. The team has been named and confirmed, and it was as briefed to the papers. Jordan Larmour starts at fullback. Keith Earls and Jacob Stockdale are on the wings. Robbie Henshaw and Bundy Aki renew their centre partnership. At out half, Jonathan Sexton returns. Conor Murray is the number nine. It's Keane Healy, Rory Best captaining the team, and Tadhg Furlong in the front row. Ian Henderson and James Ryan are four and five. Tadhg Byrne, Josh van der Fleer and CJ Stander are the back row, which is interesting enough, 6, 7 and 8, because Peter O'Mahony is on the bench. So Peter O'Mahony and Jean Klein are on the bench to cover the back row and the second row, and the front row bench is pretty much as you'd expect. Niall Scannell, Dave Kilcoyne and Andrew Porter are the sub front rows, with Luke McGrath, Joey Carberry and Andrew Conway making the bench at number 23. So yeah, it feels pretty close between Conway and Jordan Larmour at the moment in terms of who will actually make the bench if Rob Kearney is fit. Luke McGrath and Joey Carberry is definitely your first choice subs for scrum half and out half. So this looks like he's picked his full team. This is the team if everybody's fit, with maybe one exception, and that's Tadhg Byrne at sixth ahead of Peter O'Mahony. So maybe Peter O'Mahony comes back into the team, and at that point Tadhg Byrne replaces John Klein, and John Klein drops out, and maybe Reece Ruddock comes back in to cover the back row as well. So it's a pretty strong team. It's the strongest team that Ireland could possibly have named at this point for the game against Samoa. 7 minutes past eight this morning. Just a recap on what's happened overnight. So the Rugby World Cup made the announcement that two games have definitely been cancelled this weekend. Not postponed, they have been cancelled. England against France and New Zealand against Italy were both cancelled. No word yet on whether or not Japan against Scotland will go ahead. As things stand, it's slated to go ahead, but a decision will be made 12 hours before kickoff about whether or not it's safe to continue with that game. If that game is deemed a nil-all draw, both teams will be awarded 2 points. Scotland will be out irrespective of what happens, but Japan will top the group irrespective of what we do against Samoa on Saturday. So it's going to be a very interesting weekend from an Irish rugby perspective, certainly from an administration perspective and everything else that happens as well. Because ultimately, it could well be decided that Japan will face South Africa in the boardroom as opposed to being decided on the field of play. Japan will obviously face South Africa on the field of play as opposed to in the boardroom. You know what I mean? So 8 minutes past eight this morning, we're going to get continued analysis and reaction to that. Wherever you're watching this morning, you could leave us a comment. We're streaming live on youtube.com/offtheball. We're streaming live, of course, on Facebook and on Periscope. The best place to get us these days, though, is on the GoLad app, where we have a full 24-hour sports radio station for your delectation. It's called OTB Sports Radio. Now, we'd love to hear what you think about that. You can email us or drop us a text. We're going to go through the team in a few moments with Keith Wood on the Irish side. Let's go back to the Republic of Ireland, though, because obviously great news coming from them overnight, that Shane Duffy is part of the travelling party to head to Tbilisi in Georgia for the game at the weekend. A victory there would set us up very nicely with just a couple of games left in the qualifying campaign. We still have a good chance of actually topping this group if things go our way. Here is Seanan McGuire talking about the influence of Robbie Keane.
I don't feel the pressure at all, to be honest. Obviously, it makes you want to obviously open your account and obviously make that dream come true and score for your country. But as I mentioned before, it's been frustrating, obviously not getting that first goal and performing well when given a chance. But obviously there'll be no better time to get it in these next two games, and hopefully I can, you know, get that chance.
Sean, have you spoken to Robbie Keane about that, and has he been giving you much coaching there in the setup?
Yeah, massively. I think I've been involved now in three international, you know, setups with Robbie, and even in training. For example, even yesterday after training, we stayed out for 15 minutes, and he was telling me obviously 80-90% of his goals are scored within the box, one touch, two touches, and that's something that I aspire to, and hopefully I can do better on. I've scored three goals this season, and playing off the left, but even just giving me tips here and there can only make me better.
Phil Egan is with us. Phil, do you think Sean McGuire is going to start, or how close is he to the starting team at the minute?
I don't think he's going to start. I think the way Mick has talked, I think James Collins has now moved ahead of Sean McGuire in the pecking order of that Bulgaria game. The way Mick McCarthy said about how he occupied defenders, he got up and Adam and physical with them, and that's what Mick likes.
Yeah.
Don't think he's going to start Aaron Connolly either.
No, he's not going to start Aaron Connolly. That would be like completely out of character with... Yeah.
But I think Aaron Connolly is a great option for...
30 years of management.
20 minutes to go.
If you were picking the team, would you start him?
No.
Really?
Because it's going to be an absolutely dire match.
Yeah.
So basically we're going to slug it out with them.
You've got a bit of quality.
Yeah, but we're going to slug it out with them, and what will end up happening is... It might get a bit more open in the last 20 minutes when they tire. They tend to tire. This is where teams tend to get the results against Georgia late on. And that's when you bring on Aaron Connolly. We might have enough of the ball, Ger, where he's just going to be chasing shadows for the first...
Making runs, that's called.
Yeah, but if you don't get him the ball, it's just making runs for nothing. So bring him on fresh legs. And the beauty of it as well is I'm sure the Georgian team will have seen Aaron Connolly playing against Spurs at the weekend, but... They won't know that much about him.
Yeah.
They'll be expecting the usual, the physical Irish side. And then all of a sudden, with 20 minutes to go, we throw on this whiz kid who takes the ball by a few of their players, puts one in the bottom corner and makes a genius then.
Yeah.
No?
No.
You want him to start?
Well, like, he's...
He can't finish then.
Why not?
I don't know if he... Like, it's a big step up to play... An international game.
Is it a big step up to play Georgia after playing Spurs?
Well, this Spurs team, yeah.
But, I mean, come on, you know, like the beaten team in last year's Champions League final versus Georgia, which is going to be the most difficult?
I think just the occasion, though. Like, he's still a teenager. We have to take that into account that the way he talks, he kind of strikes me as somebody that doesn't get fazed by things.
Yeah.
But it's still a hell of a big deal to be thrown in for. I think this is the most important game. This is the most winnable game of the last three. And I think if we beat Georgia on Saturday, we'll actually qualify for the Euros without having to go down the route of the playoff, the Nations League thing.
Okay, explain that to me. Go on.
Well, I just think that the fact that we're on before Denmark and Switzerland. So if we win and Denmark fail to win, that means we can get a draw in the last game against Denmark at the Aviva. Doesn't matter what happens in Geneva next Tuesday.
Because we'll be 5 points clear of them.
So I'd be quite... And, you know, if there is going to be a winner in Copenhagen on Saturday, we want it to be Switzerland.
Do we? Because then...
I've given... I just... I
You've
don't,
given up the hope of winning the group?
I'm not giving up hope, but I think... I can't see us getting any result in Geneva next week. I think Switzerland will beat us.
All right. Like, are they not flaky?
They're, yeah.
Does Geneva not have a one-all draw written all over it? Or nil-all,
possibly.
Actually, more than likely.
Yeah, no, we do score. But it depends on what happens. Does Shane Duffy... I think Shane Duffy... I'm not sure if he's got the two games in him.
Right.
But I think Mick McCarthy will try and play him this Saturday. Because I'd say Mick McCarthy's looking at Saturday's game as... Like, we hear the cliche, take one game at a time. But this is, I think, the game that we have to focus on.
Well, I mean, as you say, if we win, it's like a massive opportunity.
Oh, yeah, big time. I was in Georgia a few years ago when we drew with them, and that last 20 minutes was a bit all over the place, and I kind of think that chaos, that's where Aaron Connolly could be more effective. I just think if you play him for the first 70 minutes, I don't know, is he going to get much of the ball? I expect Georgia.
Are we a team, or are we going to have a bit more of the ball this time?
No. You think back to the home game, we beat them 1-0, but they still had a lot of possession. They'll have even more possession. It's a strange place where it's a massive stadium. It's never full. Georgia are more interested in rugby, and they kind of flit in. The crowd, if they're not given something to cheer on, it goes fairly quiet. But if they break away, the crowd get into it, and then it becomes more and more hostile. But if we keep it just tight enough and then try and take our chances in the second half.
Yeah.
Like, we scored very early. Shane Duffy scored very early. I think it was 3 minutes in the last time we were there, and it was just...
Too early.
It was... No, but you remember the Martin O'Neill teams. As soon as we scored, we just retreat and we basically gave them the ball and they let them build their confidence.
Yeah. Not a great way of playing football.
Absolutely not. So that is still in this set of players where if they score, they tend to try and hold on to what they have.
Yeah.
I'm sure he'd love to get that out of them, but he hasn't had time to work with the players.
I think he's absolutely happy what we have. We hold. He's a conservative manager, yeah. So that would actually be his perfect modus operandi. Yeah. So do we have a fair idea what the team's going to be now that Duffy's fit? Duffy and Egan play
Duffy
centre-back.
Duffy and Egan, Doherty playing left-back.
Doherty's definitely playing left-back, yeah, right?
You'd imagine so. He pretty much gave it away, didn't he, yesterday in his press conference?
What was the experiment playing Harrow left-back? What was the point of that?
I think it was just to give him game time, because at the time he wasn't in the Villa team. So it was basically, you've come over here, we'll give you another 90 minutes. And it's actually worked out very well, because he's now got back into the Villa team, because he played the League Cup game against Brighton. He obviously scored at the weekend. So yeah, his confidence is high. And even someone like Jeff Hendrick is now starting to play for Burnley. He scored at the weekend.
So they're playing in midfield, they're starting?
Yeah, Whelan as well. And then he's not going to leave out James McLean.
No, so McLean starts, but
Callum Robinson, I'd imagine.
And who's the striker?
That's where I think he might throw in James Collins. Unless he was to go with Callum Robinson as a central striker and maybe bring in someone like Callum O'Dowda. But again, O'Dowda doesn't fit into that kind of player where if you don't have the ball, what use is Callum O'Dowda?
Well, is he not good at chasing? Does he not have pace to work?
He's okay, but he wouldn't be as tenacious as somebody else where, you know, Callum O'Dowda is a nice option to have on the bench. With the like O'Dowda and Connolly, if you can bring those, if you need a goal with 20 minutes to go, those two lads there are decent options.
All right, so that's not a bad team.
It's not bad.
That's kick-off at 2 o'clock on Saturday. Are you predicting a victory for us?
I think Georgia are going to score. So if we can nick it at 2-1.
That would be great.
But it does have the 1-1 written all over it.
Yeah. 3 more 1-1 draws. What does that get us?
It probably will get us a playoff.
Sure, look, they'd bite your hand off for that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Phil, good stuff. Thanks for that. It's 17 minutes past 8 this morning. Let's go back to rugby, and I'm delighted to say we've got Keith Wood with us this morning to react to some of the big breaking news overnight, Keith, that the Typhoon has already scrubbed 2 games this weekend, which means that Italy don't get to play their final game in the World Cup. They're gone. It means that New Zealand will be very well rested by the time the quarterfinals roll around, as will England and France. From an Irish perspective, we're still waiting to find out exactly what the story is with the Scotland-Japan game. But if you're Scottish at the moment, you must be very concerned that the tournament organisers are going to have a fairly handy out to put Japan in the quarterfinals.
Absolutely. And whether this is a very sad indictment on my own existence, but I was up at 4:30 and watched that press conference live, which is disturbing because most of it was in Japanese, which my Japanese isn't great. I think once they announced the fact that they were going to have that press conference this morning, I think everybody's fears kind of grew. And it's trying to figure out what's the subtext behind why there weren't different alternatives. So like the risk assessment that they have, which was that they'd written it into their contracts that if a game was cancelled, it was a nil-all draw. I'm going to presume that they were written into the previous contracts as well. I mean, I don't know that you'd say they were necessarily for Typhoons just in this one, but maybe that's a standing running way that it happens. But there are huge, incredible safety and logistical problems. So, and I think you have to accept all of those. But you wonder, is there not a contingency to be able to play a game within closed doors? Where you can actually just get to a proper result to give some idea of equity, because it takes an element of the sporting side of it out of it, actually, because suddenly someone is rested more, somebody gets through with a match they should have won, then it's everything's in the lap of the gods. And I think that happens to be the case a lot of the time. So for me, it's not that their decision making isn't right now, it's whether their decision-making and some of the risk assessment early on wasn't more thought through. So this is the worst possible scenario on the worst possible day, a weekend, because they've already said they have a different contingency for the knockout stages because they don't have to deal with the logistics of 20 teams.
Yeah, I think one of the contingencies for the knockout is they'll move the quarterfinals from Tokyo to the south of the country, which looks like is going to escape most of the ravages of the typhoon. That was what Owen was telling us a little bit earlier on, which is absolutely fair enough. So long as they make that announcement now and everybody has the opportunity to plan for that quarterfinal in advance. But the point you make, like, this is typhoon season. They have a contingency because they know there's a possibility of typhoons coming. There's a couple of key games this weekend that really we all knew from the start were going to be the key games. You just need an alternative venue to be able to play them, or play them a day later, or play them 3 days later, or play them 2 days early. Like, surely there could have been some plan made for that.
Yeah, it goes back to something from 6 months ago or 2 or 3 years ago when that contingency was done. Apparently the nature of this storm is of such a magnitude that it is destructive and dangerous, and you do need to make certain that people are kept safe. But there is an element of you absolutely need to get those games played. So how do you do it? Any other option is a better option. So what are the pressures that are coming on to play that they're not able to do that? Because I think we got part of the story this morning. I don't believe we've got all of it. And it'll become very interesting then as to whether there was pressure from TV or sponsors or fans or whatever way that goes. And I think fans get annoyed, but they're all going to get their money back. But they don't get their money back from the flights that were over there, all that sort of stuff. It's tough, but these things do happen. I think there is a harsh reality. Look, we don't get those storms, but you know that if you ever try and organise anything in the middle of the summer in Ireland, it's guaranteed to rain on top of you. You know, that's what happens. You know, but what are the alternative contingencies? So, I never knew of those contingencies until about 2 weeks ago when they were having a discussion about whether Ireland would miss the first game, and they said, well, if the game it can't be played, it's a nil-all draw.
Yeah,
and I said, okay, that doesn't sit right. You know, that just doesn't sit right. So, and people are saying that they're complaining that it's in the typhoon season and that it shouldn't be on in this time at all. I don't agree with that. This is the particular window that World Cups are in. And I think it's we roll the dice with it in a couple of occasions. But I think you just need to make certain that you can play the games.
Yeah.
So I don't look. I don't know. I think they looked. I mean, there was the stories that they'd looked at it and they couldn't seem to find a route to be able to do it. I don't know why that is. I just, you would think that it's in everybody's interest to have the games played.
Yeah, I mean, the Football World Cup was in Korea and Japan. I wonder, was there any even possibility of renting a stadium in Korea and playing the game over there, flying people out from the south? Like, there's definitely a way to do this if you want to do it, to get the games played.
Yeah, it's funny. There's practicalities of being able to get something done. There also then are there different issues in terms of all the stakeholders. I don't know. As I said, I think we got an answer this morning, but we didn't get all the answers. I think there might be more at play here. So for me, it's just a bit of a shame because I'm loving the World Cup and. Some people say that the games are very one-sided. I just haven't seen that. This is the least one-sided World Cup. I played in a World Cup in 95 where Japan were beaten by New Zealand by 145 points. So it's changed an awful lot since then. And I just find that I'm excited by a lot of the games that I wouldn't thought I'd be excited by. I've been excited by some of the improvements. So, look, I just think this makes it hard. And it makes it hard then quarterfinal time because people have longer rest.
Yeah, yeah. And look, we'll talk about the impact of that in a minute. I want to just bring in some of this stuff that Conor O'Shea was saying. Clearly, everyone is down because we wanted to have the chance to play against New Zealand. For us, it was our next challenge and perhaps for the last time for Sergio Parisse, Alessandro Zani and Leonardo Geraldini to play. And the chance to give young players a chance. Apparently, I'm just reading today, this morning, Geraldini had been rehabbing for effectively a year to get the opportunity to play, to say goodbye, and broke down in tears when the news came through that the game wasn't going ahead. So, on a personal level for them, it's awful that they haven't had the opportunity to say goodbye in the field of play.
Yeah, it is. Look, I did something similar in 2003. I had three operations to play in that World Cup. If I was suddenly said, actually, no, it's you can't play for a non, you know, rugby reason, really, yeah, of course you're going to be totally pissed. You know, you're not going to enjoy that in any way, shape or form. So it's, look, I just think there are, I know that they've taken health and safety as paramount, right? I agree with the health and safety element. I really do. Of course you have to. And the idea of it being this late is, in many respects, I think they were hoping against hope that it might move further to the right and away off the islands of Japan. But with that not happening, I think they've had to make decisions. You just wish there was something else. And I think it probably goes back to the risk assessments and World Cup contract from a few years ago. So it's what stands there, because if you do something that deviates from that, does that open you to litigation, or what is the story? So, like, again, this is speculation, because we've only had a sort of bleary-eyed half or a press conference to go on and the decision that's made. So I think it's very upsetting for the, as you say, there's a human element to it. There's a human element to the fans who've traveled over there too. You know, it's a very expensive trip, and there's people have saved for a long time to go over and to see it. So it is. Look, it's tough.
Yeah, no, for sure. The Ireland team has been named in the background to all this as well. So it's a very strong team. Jordan Larmour is at fullback. The wings are Keith Earls and Jacob Stockdale. It's Robbie Henshaw and Bundy Aki in the centre. It was great to see Robbie Henshaw back. Conor Murray and Jonathan Sexton are the 9 and 10. It's our first choice front five. Kian Healy, Rory Best, Tyke Furlong, Ian Henderson, James Ryan. Then it goes Tyke Byrne at 6, Josh van der Fleer at 7, and CJ Stander at 8. The subs, Scannell, Kilcoyne, Porter, Klein and O'Mahony, and then Luke McGrath, Carberry and Conway. It's about as strong a team as he could possibly have named. There's still a suggestion that Rob Kearney is injured, and that's why he's not been included in the squad. So basically your first choice team, it's do or die now for Ireland.
Well, it is do or die. I think once we lost to Japan, it definitely was. I look at the team, and I think maybe 3 or 4 months ago, you might have said that was guaranteed to be the full-strength Irish team. But I do think other players have put their hand up in the last period of time. I think Conway has played very well in this World Cup. I think Dave Kilcoyne has played very well within it, to name two. It's great to see Joey Carberry back on the bench. And I really hope he's back at full fitness, because an awful lot seems to rest on Johnny. And I think you can put a lot to rest on Joey if he's fit. So he looked nervous, I think, when he played a couple of weeks ago, and it didn't seem to be right for him. So he needs to be incredibly confident as well, and I think we can get an awful lot from him. But we need to go out to this game with an idea of, I think we touched on this over the last couple of weeks, of getting that level of focus and aggression and smart play in as much as we possibly can. So it's hard to even say at times if we truck it up a little bit close to them, that seems like a better option than having a couple of missed passes where the Samoan midfielders line you up and they're looking for the big hits all the time. And one of the elements that Samoa have said is that they don't understand a lot of the referees' interpretations of the tackle, and they don't agree with it, which is why they have a couple of guys suspended and they're not doing it. And they say they want to continue playing in the manner in which they already play, which I don't like as a phrase. So we've seen even over the last weekend that the tackle height has to come down. It's come down because the referees are going to penalise you if they don't. So I just think we need to be incredibly well disciplined. It's a very good team. There's players that are playing who haven't played particularly well in this World Cup. They are the frontline players. They need to deliver on this day, because I think from even some of the performances in the last week or two, I still think there are positions up for grabs.
Any in particular positions up for grabs at the moment, do you think?
Well, to be honest, I think Rory Best has to play well. He has to win his lineouts. He has to do as well as he possibly can. I think our back row need to play well. We need to get over the gain line, because at the present moment in time, the ball has been very slow for us. I think Conor Murray has been a little bit slower to the ball because he's fighting for it an awful lot. He's not running onto it. It's not presented on a plate to him like it is to some of the other teams. I think it's a really big day for Tyburn because Peter O'Mahony has always been picked. The one thing I do like about having Peter O'Mahony on the bench is I feel we're very light in the last 20 minutes in terms of leadership. And I'd like to have a leader on the field in the last 20. We've been taking off our leaders, and I don't like that at all. So that's the big plus about having a player of his seniority on the bench.
So do you think then that Tyburn has an opportunity to win the starting six for a quarter final if he plays well? Or I can't decide if Tyburn is the bench player and at this point Rhys Ruddock is still in the mix for a starting berth. Or where? So if Ruddock's not in this squad, does that mean he's got no chance of starting a quarter final?
I don't think that's true. I just think Ruddock. I have huge admiration for Ruddock. I think he's a really fine player. He seems to always pick up an injury at the wrong time, and he's not there. He has just bristled in the last few matches that he's played. So I think he's a viable option. He's a viable alternative. We just need to have more energy on the field. I'd like to see us playing at that high level of energy that we have, that we played against Scotland. Now, we were given space, and we go back to Scotland, we're abject, but we were given space to play and we played it very well. But we have to be able to up our pace at some stage. Tyburn is a brilliant guy for snaffling the ball. He is a good line-out jumper. He has a lot of experience, but not a huge amount of international experience, depending on who you're playing. If we're playing New Zealand, I think it could be a difference. It will be a different selection than if we're playing South Africa. And that's so I think, I still think Joe is trying to have all the aces in the hole for whatever match we actually have. So I think you could pick Ruddock to play against South Africa. I think you definitely have Peter O'Mahony on against the All Blacks.
And the extra time that the All Blacks have off now, is there any hope that some...
We can't deal with that. No, we can't. We can't even worry about it. We can't think about it. And... look, one of the elements of sport is one of the truisms. Things happen all the time, and you just have to deal with it. You can't bemoan it. You can't say that it isn't. We can a little, you know, because we're supposed to a little. But the team have to think, okay, this is what's happening. We have to deal with it. Whatever way we have to deal with it, we have to get onto it. We have to play the next one. We have to deal with whatever the circumstances are, the conditions are, whether the other guys are fresher or not fresher. I don't know whether that means they're rusty or they're not, but the truth of it is we can't worry about the All Blacks or South Africa. We only have to worry about ourselves. Can we be in the best place we possibly can? Can we bring the highest level of accuracy and aggression that we need to, depending on the team that we're playing against?
So are you throwing out the performance against Russia in a way that this is the...
Oh, I did. I threw it out the morning after.
And so this is the chance for this team, because this is the first time that this team has played together in the World Cup, obviously because we haven't had certain players available at various stages, but this is the first time this 15... will start for Ireland. It's their chance to hit a reset button and go, okay, so the World Cup starts here, we win this game, and our next game is knockout against one of the best teams in the world, but we've beaten them both in the last 18 months, so we actually have really properly have nothing to fear from this point forward.
I've always felt that to be the case, I have to say, and in any of our conversations, I'd say, yeah, I thought we'd win all our games, by the way, so I didn't predict us losing to Japan, but I thought we'd get out of our group. We'd be first or second. That's pretty much where we're going to be if we win this game at the weekend. But we have to prove that. So this is like a knockout game. So against Samoa, we have to be bristling. We have to be accurate and disciplined. And this team is picked. These are the guys with the jerseys. And at this stage in a World Cup, you're holding on to the jersey. And the way you hold on to the jersey is you deliver in the jersey. So there is pressure on everybody here to play bloody well, and they have to play well because there are other guys who, when they got the chance with the jersey, did do very well. So once this weekend is off, it depends what injuries you have. It depends on a whole variety of different options and eventualities. But every guy who wears an Ireland jersey, they're trying to put down the marker now. So all the shadow boxing is gone now. this is a knockout game. We lose this game, we're gone, pretty much, I think.
Yeah,
I
yeah.
know they're, you know, and even irrespective of what happens, playing or not playing, you know. So we have to concentrate on going and winning the game and scoring four tries. That's we have to do that. So this is a knockout game. And it's if you're ever looking, we just don't do doubt very well. We don't do favourites tag very well. So we're favourites in here, but we're also with our backs against the wall. We tend to perform well under those circumstances. You know, there's the options for Ireland are incredibly limited on this one. We have to win the game.
Do you have any understanding yet of exactly what has happened to the sense of certainty that we had 18 months ago, where that didn't come back, even after the Scotland game, where it looked like we had it back, where we were playing well again, where the ball was sticking, where the bounce was going our direction because it looked like we had earned the good luck. Why did that disappear in the Japan game, and why did it not? Why do we not have it back just yet?
Yeah, I still feel I felt we got shell shocked. If I go back to see how we played last year, 2018 was. It was a joy to watch. We were confident. We were injury free. We had a lot of players in really good form. I think we caught a couple of teams cold, which is always good too when that happens. We kind of use it against ourselves at times, but we also have to use it for ourselves. I thought we got a shock in January. I thought we got out-muscled. And England played a style of rugby that we hadn't seen in terms. It wasn't just heavy hitting and strength. It was very, very powerful. And we got knocked out of kilter. And I thought we lost a bit of our composure then. I felt we did the exact same thing in the preseason matches. So we came back from a heavy couple of weeks of training. England had played two big matches. And I feel that was a mistake. I actually feel we lost a huge amount of confidence from that day. Because the reality, I remember talking to one of the coaches, not one of the Irish coaches, one of the provincial coaches earlier on, and they said, "Sure, we're absolutely brilliant because we haven't played a match yet." You know, it's only when you play the first match you kind of get a chance to see. But you weren't looking for like with like, and I thought our confidence took a big kick. It's why I was thrilled to bits when we played against Scotland, that we played with that big, hard-pressed defence with a high level of aggression, a high level of pace. We looked fast, we looked light on the ground. But I did put the caveat in that Scotland, for some reason, played like we did against England in the warm-up games. They stood back on their heels. They didn't have any energy in the game. They gave us space to run into it, and we took it. But then the following week, which really I didn't get, I felt our defensive line was very slow. And it's that little bit of doubt that we get into our head when that happens. And Japan play like a perpetual motion machine. They're having a go at everything. It is a joy to watch. Irrespective of them playing Ireland and beating Ireland, when you see people who are, okay, they have a mixture of guys from the South Sea Islands playing for them, but there is a Japanese spirit in it where, do you know what, let's have a go. We're going to have a go at everything. The worst thing we can do is fail. You know, and that's a joy to watch. Japan have it on their home turf, and the weather maybe suits them a bit more, but it can't suit them that much more. You know, it still has to be a pain in the neck for them to play with a slippery ball because they're trying to fling it everywhere. But the joy that they have in playing and the never stop spirit that they have is. It's fantastic. So they're getting, in many respects, what they deserve when they go and play. And it also proves that their beating of South Africa 4 years ago was not a fluke. It was, I think, almost the schedule 4 years ago was against them.
Yeah.
They had to play Scotland 4 days later, and they were shattered trying to do it because you couldn't get back up either in an emotional or a physical way to do it. So, look, I don't know. For me, I think it's confidence. For me, it's pulling the squad together and saying, we've done things really well in the past. We've done things really badly in the past. Can we just iron out some of the things that seem to destabilize us in terms of confidence? And that's our best chance. And I know that sounds a bit simplistic, and in many respects it is simplistic. But how many times have we been on this show? How many times have we watched Ireland play and have a dreadful performance, maybe scratch out a win or lose, and then the following week, knock over one of the big teams in the world. It's, we have that capacity. There is a good institutional rugby memory in this team, and we do require our players to be firing, but they have to tap into those good feelings that they had, kind of Happy Gilmore in some respects. You know, they just, well, they look under pressure, and you need to smile.
Yeah.
I mean, we mentioned it in the World Cup in 2015, that people couldn't understand when they bumped into the Australian rugby team, how happy they were, how out in the public they were, how comfortable they were, because they know it's a huge pressure. So they don't need to be thinking about the pressure. You know, they have a better history in this competition than we have. So I still think, I'm not being naive about it or going entirely with my heart about it. We have capacity, but we need to perform for it. And we need to let the shackles off. And that doesn't mean run the ball left, right and centre. No. That isn't in this team. We haven't played that way. We don't play that way. We play with a level of control. But the shackle for me is pressure. And you go back and you say you may only have one World Cup in your career, or you may have two. You have to take that opportunity.
Yeah, no, for sure. Keith, great stuff. Thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Cheers, Ger.
Keith Wood giving us some thoughts on the big breaking news overnight. The two World Cup games have already been scrubbed, and there's a strong potential that the Japan-Scotland game will also be scrubbed, which means that irrespective of what Ireland do against Samoa, even if we win the bonus point, we'll end up finishing at best second in our Rugby World Cup group. For the massive audience we have on YouTube this morning, you're very welcome. Remember to hit the subscribe button in the top corner, and every time we go live, we'll ping you with a little message to let you know that you're not missing any of our best work here from OTB. OTB Sports Radio, of course, live on the Go Loud app and wherever it is that you listen. So you can get us on TuneIn or Alexa or Google Home or offtheball.com/radio as well. It's 8:42 this morning. You're watching OTB AM. We're live every morning from 7:30 with Ireland's first and only sports breakfast show. After 9 o'clock, we're going to cross back to Japan to hear from Joe Schmidt and Richie Murphy up next. Delighted to say that Irish athlete Kieran McGean is in the studio. First, let's hear from last night's programme, where Louise Quinn joined the lads to chat about the FAI's appointment of Vera Powell as Ireland's women's national team boss.
I just think in terms of, obviously, the quality of coach that they've picked, has been brilliant, and you just have to have a look at her CV and her record. She's an absolute quality coach. So they really didn't, they really didn't hold back on trying to find the best that they could that was there. So there's always ways that, things can be improved, and it's constant as in terms of us from players, and then of course from your association. We want to keep building and doing that. But first of all, just the appointment I think that they've made with Vera has been, has been a brilliant one. And then you can see the buzz behind it as well with Eileen being there and really capturing. She has been in that national league for years and has been around. So I think it really has just been a great mix of bringing in a massively experienced coach and then someone who
has local knowledge
inside out.
Yeah, so that's Louise Quinn last night. Kieran McGean is with us. You were at the game on the other night.
I was. It was fantastic. It's actually my first FAI game, and it was brilliant. I was on the edge of my seat the whole time.
Plenty of drama. It's good to go 2-0 up. Everybody gets calm, then introduce a little bit of chaos, jeopardy to the evening.
Yes, the girls certainly provided me with entertainment that day, much to their dismay, I'm sure, because they were two soft goals, but they had two fantastic goals of their own. And look, it showed testament to their grit and their determination, because they came back and they kept their head. And that's a very big lesson for anybody in sport.
How's your jet lag?
Oh, it's good. I'm actually flying. I've been up since 6 o'clock. I got tested this morning. If anybody wants to see my wee say no to doping plaster.
That's how they give you that after they drug test you.
Well, I'm very lucky because my testers today was like, I keep this sticker for special people. So I'm feeling really chuffed, because usually you just get a plain one. But yeah, I've been up since 6, so I'm feeling right as rain.
Do they wake you at 6 this morning? Is that how that works?
Yes, they ring the doorbell, and I rush down the stairs trying
to make sure you're not one of the people
who ring it again, because I'm not even in my own house. I'm here in my boyfriend's house, so his whole house is like, who the hell's ringing at 6 in the morning? So if the doorbell goes in the early hours, I know it's for me.
Is it so that when the doorbell goes at 6 in the morning, you're like, oh, I'm getting tested again?
Yeah, because nobody else comes to our door at 6 a.m. So and or else it's the police, and I hope everybody's okay. So I know that it's the testers and it's for me, so up I get. But I'm delighted to be tested. It's an important thing, and
especially in the wake of what's just happened.
Yeah, it's been an interesting championships for athletics with all of the stuff around Salazar, and it took away a little bit, I think, from the championships itself, which was a little disappointing. But as a clean athlete, I'm happy whenever sanctions are brought into place to people who are clearly cheating the rules and really bringing our whole sport into disrepute and casting a shadow over athletics as a whole. So it's an important thing, and I'm happy that USADA have conducted that investigation and sanctioned a ban.
Yeah, because the noise around athletics and the noise around the Nike Oregon project is something that, you know, you can't talk about that much until something actually happens, and then it's like, oh, it turns out Salazar's now been done for 4 years because of doping violations, and it casts a massive shadow over anybody who's been associated with that project for such a long period of time, and over the company who has bankrolled Salazar for such a long time, which is like the most important company in athletics in many ways, or one of them. So your whole sport ends up feeling a bit damaged and feeling a bit bruised and a bit tender about the whole thing.
Definitely, and it's something that you feel personally whenever you're out there racing a championship. So I want to step off the track and my interviews to be about my performance, not about somebody else's performance necessarily, or whatever negative things they've done to get that attention. So it's tough. Nike are a huge player in athletics, and people could say they control an awful lot of aspects of our sport. It's very disappointing to see a coach being banned, and it is tough out there. I know a few athletes made statements and broad statements about the Oregon project. I know some of the athletes are in the Oregon project, absolutely lovely people, but as an athlete myself, I make sure that all the associations I make are with people that I want to be associated with. It is very hard as an athlete, and my reputation is my own, and I don't want it to be tainted by an association with anybody else. So that's the tough thing, and it's up to those athletes. One of the lasting things, and it's an interesting thing because I've heard this conversation from other people, and it made me think that's actually pretty true, that a lot of the athletes came off and they said they're very angry about what happened with Salazar, but they weren't angry at Salazar. If that was my coach, I would be absolutely distraught that they had cast a shadow over me as an athlete, because everything I do is to represent my country with pride, to represent my family with pride, and to know that I'm a clean athlete. So if somebody brings your reputation into the clouded area of doped sport, that's a tough thing. So I think people need to be angry at Salazar, and if somebody's willing to murk the waters, then it is good that they're challenged.
Okay, I just want to play you some audio. You've got earphones on.
I
you.
Do.
Stick them with me there. Yeah. So this is in the aftermath of Sifan Hassan speaking to the BBC after her win in the 1500. Have a listen.
Mm-hmm. It was a very hard week for me, and I was just so angry, and I couldn't talk to anyone. I just ran all out, and I just wanted people saw that hard workers can beat everything, can be better than everything.
When you say you were so angry and upset, is it because of what happened with your coach? Is that what made you so angry to run that time?
Yeah, it's like that's what made me angry. I have been clean all my life. I work hard. I'm actually no emotional person, but it makes me so mad when people... I have been in top almost 5 months. How can I do the things that so hard? And you can't see my body. You can't see how I always couldn't stand. I've been so good athlete since 2014. Now people just start talking all... I'm sorry for my language.
Okay. She doesn't seem angry at Salazar.
No, and that's something that I would... I personally feel, and it's not a thought that I came up all of my own, because it's been interesting. There's clearly been a lot of discussion about this in media, and these are discussions that need to happen. I'm happy to discuss about clean sport and about instances where people are banned. But stepping off the track and saying that you're angry because your coach was caught for manipulating the sport, manipulating testing, for putting athletes' health at risk and putting our sport in complete disrepute is it's frustrating as an athlete, because if I ever thought that a coach of mine was associated with something that I don't want to be associated, I would distance myself from that setup as far as I possibly could.
Because you're responsible for that. You're a sole trader when it comes down to it. You're the one who gets the glory. You're the one who puts in all the hard work.
Yeah.
And ultimately, it's you alone in that race.
Yeah, it's all up to me. And it is hard because then you have aspects like that. I can only put my own hat on my own head. I don't know who is clean or not clean in any sport. But whenever somebody's cast in that doubt, it takes away from the clean performances as well. That championship had some absolutely amazing performances. That women's 1500 was the fastest 1500 really in history. Like, my time would have won 7 out of the past 8 world championships. Like, the girls, the girl who came fourth ran 3:54. I watched her cool down on the indoor track with tears in her eyes. She ran 3:54 and she came fourth at a world champs. Now, there's performances of that championship that I am absolutely in awe of, because I believe that those athletes have done it and that they deserve the credit for the hard work that they've put in. Then whenever you have athletes who have questions and doubts over their head, they ruin that for the rest of us and the fantastic performances that we've had. So it is tough. I have
you had the discussions with other athletes and about what you're going to do about it.
Discussions that you just are in shock that like, this is the sport that we compete in and we try our best in, and every time I step out there I want to do the best that I can possibly do, and I train my whole life. I work my backside off to dedicate my life's work to athletics. And it is so infuriating for us that people are still out there manipulating it. And these are often discussions that you have in athletics among athletes. You'll see a performance and you go, I came off the track and didn't know what time she had ran until I met Cathal Dennehy at Dennehy, and he was like, what did you think of Hassan's performance? And I knew she won. And he's like, 3:51. And I just went, what? 3:51? That's fast. Like, I walked to my coach, and having ran a PB to come top 10 in a world championships, I would have taken his hand off to be offered that at the beginning of the year. And I came away with, like, I was like, Steve, what can I do? Because my dream is to win world-class medals for Ireland. And I know that I can run sub 4 minutes. I know that I can get into the realms of, I don't know, let's dream 3:55. But I do know that I'm not run 3:51. That's not a realistic goal for me. Now, can humans do that? Who knows? But with those questions over, we can't even appreciate fully what a clean human being can do.
Yeah, like, from your perspective, right, that can go one or two ways. Like, you can be completely depressed and sit in a darkened room for months and months and go, this is the reality of the situation I'm in. Or you can do what it seems you're doing, is to take the fight out there and go, look, I'm not going to accept this.
Yeah.
I'm going to be part of a group of athletes who actually, because previously a lot of athletes in your position would have come in and hemmed and hawed and said, well, it's disappointing and I don't really want to talk about it. That's, you know, all I can do is step out on the track and I know I'm clean and that's it. But actually, you're addressing this.
Yeah,
you're taking this fight. And I think that unless you as athlete do take that fight, the sport is screwed.
Yeah, it is. And this is something that you have so many people in athletics that are so passionate about this sport being clean. And I do believe the majority of athletes are. And this is our sport. We absolutely love it. And we want to see it excel. And we don't want it tainted by this. And at the championships, I didn't want to discuss that. I came off after the races and I'm not there to discuss other people. This is my performance and I want to race it. And even now, yeah, I want to discuss my performance. But it's not an aspect that I can ignore. It's there.
I think you're right, though. I think you're right for your own. For, like, in 20 years' time, when you sit back and look back at what you did, it was like you took the fight, and the fight wasn't just for yourself to run your best time, but your fight was to run in a fair race.
Yeah.
And that's the legacy that you'll have if you stand up and say these things now.
I'm very proud to be an athlete, a clean athlete, a tested athlete. I thank the testers every time they come to my house. That's why they give me a special sticker. They're doing me a great service by testing me. And I do believe that these investigations need to keep happening, because testing can only catch so many.
Yeah.
But then that's the hard thing too. Like, I look at athletics and we get, and rightly so, the attention is there and we get a hard time. People are often like, oh, sure, they're all on it. But we're not. There's so many clean athletes out there, and I have teammates that I see doing all of the work, and I believe that all of us are clean. other sports test positively, and they're probably not branded the same way as my sport, and that's tough for me too. Like, I look at sports that make so much more money than athletics. It's not an affluent sport. You look at soccer and rugby and how much money goes into those sports, and you tell me that they're not dirty also.
Yeah, no, they are. They're filthy.
Yeah,
they're absolutely filthy.
Yeah, it's not as much in the media. So I think it's something across the board of sport that needs to be addressed, and I'm very grateful to those people that are starting to address it.
Yeah, soccer basically has turned a blind eye to testing for years, and in rugby had a minor little conversation about it in the build-up to the World Cup when a member of the South African squad tested positive. The emerging young player of the year last year tested positive, like very, very high profile.
Yeah.
And it's kind of disappeared as a story now as the World Cup has gone on.
I didn't hear much about that.
Because the players, because the tournament has kicked off. Let's talk about your performance then, because a top 10 in the world. So you said you would have bitten your coach's hand off at the start of the year. How do you feel now about it? What's the...
Do you know what? I'm absolutely delighted. I came into this season with the aim of making a world final. I made it. I excelled where I was placed to come. I think I was ranked 14th. But I'm not going to say I'm content. I'm still I'm a little disappointed in the sense that I was like, oh, there's a big gap there between first and 10th. I'm going to say between even 4th and 10th. That's where I want to be running. I want to get myself down there in my career. And I believe that there's not going to be another 1500 that's ran that fast at a championship ever. So I know that if I can get into the realms of that sub 4, that I'm going to be a competitive athlete on a world stage. And that's where I want to be.
How do you do it?
Pretty much what I'm doing now. What I've been doing with Steve, my coach in Manchester, Team NB Manchester, has worked. I've been with him for coming on 2 years now, and the progression in my performance, I think it's visible and it's palpable. People can see even just how happy I am in the sport and how much I'm enjoying it. So it's going to be pretty much more of the same. We're going to be aiming this year. I've started doing altitude training, which for the first time in my life, whenever I joined Steve's group, and that's made huge leaps and bounds for me, and I find it very useful, and it's something that an awful lot of athletes use. It gets you such huge advantages in your blood composition. So that's going to be a major part of my prep towards Tokyo. And basically just that natural little bit of progression. I think people do get carried away and think, oh my goodness, I need to train so much harder. I'm training hard already.
Yeah.
If I train even harder, I'm at risk of tipping over. You tread a very fine line in sport. So my coach is doing the right thing. He's planned it out meticulously, and I have complete trust in him.
You ran 4:15. Which is a personal best, right?
Yeah.
And Sonia Sola's record is 3:58.
Mm-hmm.
How do you get there?
Just exactly what I said. Everything that I've been doing, I keep doing it, because I know that this season there's a sub 4 performance there. I ran 4.015, so like literally 0.15 of a second off sub 4. And that's a huge life ambition for pretty much every 1500 metre runner. And I ran that after having run 2 races previously.
Yeah.
So I know that it's there. And if you put me into a perfectly timed race, I probably could have went and done that. And I believe that I'm capable of running an Irish record. And hopefully it's there in my future.
We're sitting here at the 10th of October. The Olympics are obviously next summer. So do you work back from that to try and make sure? I mean, obviously you do, to make sure you peak for that. But like in the meantime, are there a couple of other peaks that you can get to make sure that you feel like...
You're all set.
Yeah, how does that work?
Definitely. So it's not even a case of me planning it now. This has been planned for the past 2 years since I joined the team with Steve. Everything's been planned in the lead up to the Olympic Games. Whenever I joined Steve, I had Commonwealth Games in March, and I ran 2:407s back to back, and that was a good performance for me. Now I'm going out in a championship and running 4:401. The semi-final was slow, but it was tactical, and then a 4 flat, and I know that I'm capable of doing the same again. So we have a few little plans over the next year. It's less than a year to the Olympics. It seems so strange. I've only stopped my season, and the Olympic Games are in about 9 months.
Yeah.
So my plans are going to consist of training blocks. We're going to go to probably America in the early part of the year for the guts of a month. I'll do some indoor racing. World Indoors are actually in China this year, and it's probably a toss-up. A lot of athletes are going to have to decide if they're going to or not going to go to China. It's probably likely that I won't go, but it's something I have to discuss with my coach. So I'll have a bit of an indoor season.
Why would you not go? What's in the...
it's so close to the Olympics. Two trips to Asia would be a lot, and I just need to focus on my training. I'm lucky enough to be in the position that I have my qualification standard already. I've run it 3 times, so I'm feeling very happy because the standard's a lot harder this year. So I have that confirmed, and ultimately you don't get selected for the Irish team until, I'm not sure what the cutoff date is, but it's much later in the year. It's only a couple of months, maybe 2 months even, before the Games, a month before the Games. So you don't know if you're on the team, but getting my A standard pretty much stamps that and books me my ticket. So I'm able to just focus on being in that best physical shape and peaking at the right time. So yeah, everything's going to be geared up to specific races to get me race fit and ready, and specific training kind of venues. I'm going to be up at altitude a lot next year. I find that so useful, and I think we've really started to nail it.
So how many times do you want to run full out between now and the actual start of the Olympic Games? Is there a set number?
No, there's not a set number, and I'll have specific races to help build me up. And you often have maybe a few little races, like I'm living in Manchester, so I'd run a few BMCs to be a little dust buster at the start of the season. And then as you start going, you want to get tuned and sharp. It's much like any other sport. People have to get their eye on the ball whenever yeah. they're playing camogie, hurling, soccer, rugby. You have to be that sharpness, and racing gets you that. But I find that what's probably worked well for me is having a couple of races just to get my head back in, get that focus back ready and practice your tactics, and then coming away and doing a nice training block. I seem to do much better off a training block and dropping in. So that'll probably be my plan. But flat out races, you never know. I'll always want to go out and give myself a good bash and see where I am at physically. But hopefully those flat out races will come in Tokyo.
Could you break 4 minutes in training? Is that ever possible, or is it only ever in races that you would do it?
I don't do a 1500 metres right. flat out ever in training. If I do a time trial, which is ultimately whenever we'd have a little tester in training, it's never at the full distance of my race. It could be a K, it could be 1200, it depends on what my coach is wanting from that specific session. So I very rarely ever run something like that. But whenever I train broken up 1500s. There's a few different principles when it comes to athletic training, but I hit the pace that I need to hit and faster in training, so that whenever it comes to racing,
you know that you've done it.
Your body's ready. But I'm the type of athlete as well that steps up on race day. I think every coach that I've ever had has said, you race much better than you train.
Yeah.
And
must be infuriating for the coaches. Like, if only I knew this.
No, I think my coaches have a lot of faith. They know what work that I do and the shape that it shows. And I think whenever I put this vest on, it gives me a special superpower. And yeah, it's something that I'm very happy that I can go out and I can race championships. And it seems to be the time that I basically get the best out of myself.
When was the first time you put that on?
My first Irish vest would have been Schools Cross Country Championships in Stowe, a SIAB Schools Cross Country Championships. And I think I was 15 or 16, 15 probably. So that was my first ever Irish vest, and a very proud moment.
Did it have an impact on you straight away? Did you kind of go, ooh?
Yeah, I only started athletics quite late in my life compared to some other people. It wasn't until I was in secondary school that one of my teachers was like, do you want to give cross country a lash? I had done 2 little races in primary school, but nothing special. And yeah, I went out and I wasn't the best, but slowly started to churn up, having some good results. And then joined a coach in Belfast, Eamon Christie, and really it all spiralled from there. Once I got to step foot in the track, I think people realised that there was something there. I was always good at running.
Yeah.
Wasn't as talented over the cross as I am on the track. So got on there and they realised, oh my goodness, this wee girl can run.
And then the racing obviously is something that you clearly just really enjoyed. And is it the adrenaline of the race? Is it the...
Yeah, to be honest, I've just always loved sport, any type of sport. I loved sports day whenever I was in primary school. I lived for it. I absolutely loved PE and really any sort of competition. I was a pretty aggressive kid. Had to be told a few times to tone it down. I can distinctly remember an assumption, my PE teacher telling me that this is not the Olympic Games, Kira.
You're like, don't worry, I'm going to get there.
Yeah, so the irony of that is quite funny. But yeah, I've learned to have to hone in that competitive nature and the sheer aggression that often came out quite angry. Hopefully that doesn't show as much anymore. I have a bit more of a smile on my face. But yeah, I just love that rush. I get super nervous. I'm not going to say I love race day. Like, there's other days I definitely love more, but you can't beat race day whenever you cross that line and you're you realise that you've given your all out there.
Yeah, when you talked about Boken after the race, that wasn't nerves, that was physical exertion, or was that a mixture of both?
No, that's physical exertion. I have zero nerves after the race. It's only before that I feel nervous. So for me, it's really my body. I've brought my body to the complete edge, and the only thing it knows what to do is maybe to go and throw up. I'm just at a loss. I try to avoid it, and I think, I'm not sure, there might be sports physiologists out there that'll tell me I'm wrong. I think whenever I run so hard, I build up a lot of lactate, and then it just responds to my tummy being churned up and not comfortable, because whenever I get to jog straight after and get that buffering to start happening, I don't throw up.
Yeah, so it's grand again. What do you do with the nerves? Like, how do you get rid of them? Or do you actually, is there a part of you that goes, okay, this is a big race, I feel the nerves, and that's a good thing. Have you?
Definitely, I can't get rid of the nerves, and I wish that I could get rid of some of the aspects of it, but I'm always happy to have them. It shows me that it means an awful lot to me, and any races that I've went into and not felt nervous, I haven't performed as well. So it shows me that my body's adrenalised and ready. And for me, it's really the transition and the change of my mindset towards those nerves. In the past, I found them crippling.
Right.
I didn't enjoy it. I could nearly feel close to tears before a race, whereas now I embrace that feeling. I don't overly like that sympathetic nervous system impact where I feel physically sick and I'm shaking.
Pre-race,
joking with my coach and he'd be like, you're nervous, I'll be yawning a lot.
Yeah.
Which you don't want to be yawning as you're getting in, but I know that it's just a nervous thing. I used to yawn in exams in university and school, and I'll be just shaking, just parts of my leg shaking, just this whole, I suppose you look at an animal who's getting ready to pounce. They have little twitches and they're ready, and I tell myself, no, this is my body getting ready. It's a good thing. And that mental switch is something that I've worked really closely with my coach and my sports psychologist Kate Kirby with, to address that and say this is a good thing and to identify it as positive.
Roy Keane said that the week of big games he would get a pain in his side in like old injuries, even though he hadn't been training. Like there was no physical thing that had happened, but like before the big Arsenal games, before a big Champions League game, his body would just be sore during the week beforehand. And he was like, what's this? Like, oh, big game coming at the weekend.
Yeah.
That's all it is.
The mind playing tricks on you, and you would be amazed the number of athletes, I have teammates who suddenly develop stress fracture in the lead up to a major marathon or something. You're like, we all laugh, and he'll know who he is if he ever hears this. We laugh, we're like, there's nothing wrong with you, you're ready. Your mind, I do feel like your mind starts playing tricks on you. You're like, oh, I feel a wee bit like rough there. And I think it wants to protect itself from the sheer carnage that's going to come, but I relish it.
That's obviously experience that you've learned over the last, how long, last 3-4 years, last 2 years, last 18 months even to get better at
I'd
that?
Say like the learning curve has been the whole time I've been in athletics, which is over 10 years now, but really since I've got a grasp of it, I'd say it's been over the past two years of me fully starting to address it and being able to control it.
Yeah. Is this all since you moved to Manchester? Is that all part of that whole...
Yeah, I moved to Manchester and was also working with Kate before that, so I already started trying to address it. But Steve has a really good approach when it comes to our mental state going into races, and it's something that we discuss, and he's really found really good coping mechanisms for me going into it. He identified that I was absolutely hating race day. The first race I ever raced with Steve was World Championship Indoors. And the contrast between Ciara McGeehan then and Ciara McGeehan now is you wouldn't think they're the same person. And Steve says that himself, and he's like, I learned so much from that race, watching you race that indoors and performing subpar and pretty badly and being very disappointed. He's like, you were white as a ghost before the race. You were nervous. You didn't have confidence in yourself. Whereas the Ciara McGeehan now is nervous, 100% nervous. I'm so prepped and ready, but I have confidence that I'm in the best shape that I can be, and I believe in myself, and there's a huge difference there.
Yeah, is that just because you've done the work now? Is that you can look back and go, you're still the same person, but actually this person here has looked at all of the things you can control, and you've done all that stuff.
It's definitely, and it's as simple as the fact that I write it down on paper and I discuss it, and I know that it's not a bad thing to discuss your fears. And Steve's like, how are you feeling? Steve's a big believer in the chimp paradox, if anybody knows that kind of principle towards your mental state, and that there's a little chimp in your head that likes to come out and create havoc, and I have to control that chimp. So Steve often uses that as an example. But for me, my chimp responds very well to writing a plan. So everything that I do is all planned. People would probably actually love to see it. I have a diary that every single race day is written down from the moment I wake up. That race day is completely planned out. It includes breakfast, it includes naps, it includes the very last snack that I'll have. Everything's written down to the caffeine that I'll have before the race and my recovery, because post-race is important too. And then what I'll also have is race scenarios and what's going to happen and what I'll do in those scenarios. And I write it in paper so that whenever it does happen in the race, it might not happen exactly like I thought it would.
But you've got something to fall back on.
But I've prepared, and that chimp knows that there's a plan.
Yeah.
And ultimately the plan is usually the same. We all have the same mechanism to get to the end of the race. So it's that reassurance that I know, no, I have this, it's under control, I've wrote it all down. And for me, that was such a huge part. And I think it's important for people to find what works for them, because other people might not respond as well from putting it on paper. It's something that works really for me. And I laugh, like, I'll send Steve a picture of it. He wants it right before, a couple of days before the race. And the last one is always usually something that I know will make him laugh. So my last one finished with, "You are the fighting Irish and you'll fight until the end." So I like to laugh at myself, but things like that give me strength. And yeah, I think that's really helped me with my mental health.
It's been an amazing year. What is actually next for you? The season's over properly?
So yeah, I'm on a wee break.
Yeah.
Delighted.
Are you going mad?
Oh, Jesus, mad. Yeah, I'm having sweets, crisps. I had two Canems in a row. My boyfriend told me I'm not allowed any more takeouts, but I don't care. Yeah, I have a couple of days off. So I finished racing on Saturday and I did a jog yesterday because my body was just feeling in bits.
Sure,
Whenever I was chatting to some of the lads, they're like, yes, that movement is a form of medication. And after 4 days, and my coach didn't tell me to run, but he was like, whenever you feel like it, just get out for a trot.
Yeah.
And it was lovely. Went for a run through Bushy Park. I don't usually get to stop mid-run, so I was just running, stopped, had a wee look at the birds, look at the trees. I absolutely love nature. I saw a lovely wee yellow wagtail down in Bushy Park, sat and watched it for a while. And that's stuff that I often miss whenever I'm training hard, because you just are always in the zone and you're running fast. So yeah, I'm back running, but I'll enjoy the next 2 weeks. I'm going to stay at home. I've got so many homes. Home is Manchester, where my car's parked.
Yeah.
Home is Dublin, where my boyfriend is. And home is Portaferry, where mummy and daddy and my dogs and my cat are. So I'll be going home to Portaferry soon. And I really look forward to that.
And then back to work at some point.
Back to work. Well, my life is always work. So this is probably the only time that I completely let my hair down and I'm not going to bed as early as I should. And I'm eating a little bit of everything. I do have a really healthy approach to my diet throughout the year. I'm not the type of person that won't have a treat. I believe that I need to have a wee treat and I work hard enough for it. But I'm literally making sure I'm going to make myself sick of rubbish. So yeah. I spent £20 in Super Value on sweets. So yeah, it's a bit of a joke. Don't let, I'm loose with my credit card. I have to remind myself I'm a 27-year-old. So, but yeah, I'll make the most of it. And then it's back to business. So I'll enjoy these next few weeks of being a little bit more relaxed. But I'll still be doing a little bit of jogging, a little bit of running, keep my body in check, because I'll be in bits if I don't.
Yeah.
But yeah, come ultimately the end of October, that's back to business and back to the prep for Tokyo.
Well, that's fair enough. Well, listen, massive congratulations for the stuff on the track. And I think as well, like, for us who are covering the sport, we need to be able to hear people like you say the things you say, because that gives us confidence then in saying, look, we trust you because you are actually saying the things that a clean athlete would say. Because if you weren't clean and you were saying this stuff, then you'd need to be a psychopath and you're clean enough.
Yeah, I'm not. Well, I do doubt myself sometimes, but no, I'm definitely a clean athlete.
Yeah, exactly. And the sport needs you guys, I think, who are currently competing, to be as aggressive about this as you are about your own training, because otherwise then it's hard for people to row in behind the clean athletes, because it's hard to know who they are sometimes. So.
Yeah, no, and I have to say I'm so grateful to the whole Irish public. I've been completely blown away with the response to my races and people's response to my interviews. And maybe it's nice, maybe I should show the real Ciara a little bit more often. And they've given me the confidence as well to be able to say, look, people will like you as well if you're just yourself and you show that sheer excitement and happiness of sport. And I've been blown away and I have to thank them so much for that.
Yeah, no, you're 100% right with that. Listen, thanks a million for joining us this morning and enjoy your 2 weeks holidays. They're very well earned.
Thanks a million. This is for you also.
Thanks a million. That's great. Pride of place.
Yeah.
If you missed any of our chat with Ciara, the full podcast is going to be up soon. You can watch it back on YouTube. We're going to head back to Japan next. Owen Sheehan is standing by. First, here's Joe Schmidt explaining his team for Samoa.
Rob he ran today, but was a little bit slow to pick up during the week, as was Pete Omani, as was Reese. And so we've gone with the guys who could give us the best preparation into the game, in a bit of a mix. Obviously, guys like Gary Ringrose, who I think has been outstanding so far. He's played 3 sets of 80 minutes in just 11 days. You can't expect people to keep on keeping on when that's the case. So Robbie is fresh, and we're excited to have him in there. So it is a little bit about balancing the load as well, albeit in a huge game for us.
Yeah, it is a huge game. Owen Sheehan, good morning to you. You're back again.
Good morning. How are things now?
Yeah, so how was that press conference?
Yeah, pretty good. Pretty much the same as the tone has been for the last couple of weeks. Everything's fine. Everything's good. We're sticking to the process and we're sticking to keeping the chin up. We are not going to get sucked into any of the negativity that has been spouted post-Japan, post-Russia. We are still confident in our structure and our system. And, of course, the whole point this morning was to name the team. He was mentioning there that a little bit is about managing workload. But you do get the sense that perhaps Peter Mahoney has been dropped and Tadhg Byrne is starting in his place. I certainly think that if Tadhg Byrne comes in and does a fantastic shift, puts in a great performance this weekend, it'll be tough for Peter Mahoney to get back into that position for this weekend. So that is the big news coming out of this morning's team, that Byrne is into the back row and Peter Mahoney is on the bench.
Well, because it's a first choice. It's a first choice 15 apart from that one spot, unless it is a first choice 15, in which case Mahoney's been dropped. What's the truth? Like, what is the truth? Is it just about managing load or has he been dropped?
Well, if you're managing load, Ger, how is it only one person that has their load managed out of 15? Like, it does seem suspicious to me that the one person who has been managed in terms of his load is somebody who hasn't exactly been going great so far.
What about Gary Ringrose, I suppose? Gary Ringrose has been going well and
true.
Isn't in the squad.
Good point. That's the one exception you can make to this at the moment as well. And, like, I mean, Jordan Larmour as well at 15, potentially instead of Rob Kearney, is another thing you can point to as well. Like, Gary Ringrose on form starts in this Ireland team. But if you go back to where we were before the World Cup, I think most people really had Bundyaki and Robbie Henshaw as their first choice midfield partnership. Now, though somebody who's been in very good form throughout a disappointing campaign mean that you disrupt that partnership and put him right in? I think you probably do, to be honest with you. I think Ireland don't have a whole pile of form going for them in certain areas of the pitch, and anybody who is playing excellent rugby should probably be starting. So that would suggest that Gary Ringrose is in the thoughts of Joe Schmidt to be in the first choice partnership, and it is a matter of managing his minutes. The thing with Ringrose is that he's played every minute, I think,
yeah,
of this World Cup so far. He was really due a break.
He was. So who else was up for press this morning?
So you had Rory Best alongside Schmidt, obviously, asked about the weather. They said they're just focusing on themselves, really. They didn't really get too drawn into the idea of what this does for the integrity of the competition should Scotland versus Japan get called off on Sunday. You also had James Ryan and Richie Murphy up before the media as well. Richie Murphy chatting about the conditions. It's interesting. It's a valid question at this point, asking about conditions. It kind of seems boring in every other scenario, but it has been used as an excuse. And maybe excuse is a bit strong, but it's definitely been mentioned by Joe Schmidt in the post-match interviews for the last 2 days. It has been cited quite a bit for an apparent lack of execution from Ireland, an apparent lack of form, more importantly, from Ireland. And I put it to Richie Murphy that, like, down here, it's like a nice summer's day in Ireland. It's like the weather they played in Twickenham at the start of the World Cup warm-up series. Warm, but nothing unmanageable. It's not suffocating. It's not too humid.
Yeah.
So should this allow skill execution to go back up? And Richie Murphy does think that it does. It does allow Ireland to be better.
Let's hear his answer to that question. Have a listen.
Richie, it's been also, especially in the early part of this week, just how much cooler it is down here and less humid it is in Shizuoka and Kobe. Hopefully there's enough two games at least to come. As we get later and later towards winter, how big a factor is that positively for this Irish team in terms of skill execution?
Well, I think... You know, even training today was actually quite warm, it was sort of mid-20s, but the humidity wasn't there as much. Guys were definitely more on top of the ground, a little bit faster pace probably in that. And with the less humidity, obviously ball handling it becomes a little bit easier. But once the guys are sweating and once their jerseys are starting to hold a fair bit of moisture, it obviously gets tough. But we've obviously gone back and looked through the games that we've played, and we've picked through certain areas that we want to really focus on. And, you know, our skill level or our ability to look after the ball, our ability to make good decisions in and around those contact areas is going to be key this week. You know, there's going to be a real physical edge to the game, the way Small want to play. So we have to be ready for that. And in fairness to the guys, they'll take that forward and run with it this week.
Yeah, Richie Murphy there talking about how he expects the performance to improve. Oh, and the cancelled games are going to cast a pall over all of the weekend's matches until we find out exactly what's going to happen with Japan and Scotland. How did Schmidt address this? How did Rory Best address this?
They didn't really tackle it head on in terms of what this means overall for the tournament, that they can only go and do what they can, which is go and try and get 5 points against Samoa. Now, the knock-on impact for this for Ireland is what it does in terms of them not getting the top seed. And in fairness, Schmidt was asked this directly. How would you feel if the Japan game was called off and therefore it's impossible for you to get the number one seed? And he says, well, we can't control it. And I guess it's probably the correct answer on a moment like this. I mean, what else are you supposed to say? Slamming World Rugby before this and then perhaps not holding up your own end of the bargain against Samoa would be a pretty bad look. So you can understand why Schmidt kind of sidestepped that question. Because, like, I mean, Ireland do obviously have to go and get their 5 points against Samoa. I do get a sense that, like, if Schmidt was really pissed off about this and that he really was annoyed that Ireland could face New Zealand by default almost if they do the business on Saturday, he's not actually that wound up about it. I think there is a realization that after the performance against Japan, they're happy to be in the quarterfinals. It was a rude awakening for them. They didn't necessarily expect to be in this position where they actually had to be fighting for a place in the last eight, let alone the top seed in the final match week. So I do think that their focus is actually on just making it through, and really beggars can't be choosers when it comes to South Africa versus South Africa or New Zealand, or especially when you're in a position like Ireland are in at the moment. And, like, I don't know, I just can't see any positive whatsoever to an All Blacks matchup for this Ireland team as opposed to a Springboks matchup. I just think it's a far better, I think it's a far better fit for Ireland, Jerry. Like, I know the box has been going well, and, like, you wouldn't pick them over many other teams in the tournament, but it's the All Blacks. You take the Springboks over the All Blacks 100%. So maybe privately Schmidt feels a bit differently. Maybe he does feel that come Sunday night, maybe Saturday night is the time when we'll actually get some honest reflections from Joe Schmidt on that. If Ireland come away with 5 points, then he might actually give us more of an answer in terms of what this actually does in terms of the integrity of the competition.
Yeah, I think that's the big thing. I think particularly after the quarterfinals, when you realise the benefit of an extra 3 or 4 days rest for the various teams who haven't had to play in this game. You're thinking particularly of England and France. If France beat Wales now in the aftermath of this, then I can imagine the Welsh will be pretty peeved with the fact that France had all that time to get their house in order. Or else France are actually tearing each other apart behind closed doors, locked in their typhoon and, you know, incapable of speaking to each other, incapable of doing anything other than punching the heads off each other. And maybe they emerge victorious and blinking into the sunlight going, yeah, this is great. This is who we are now. We know exactly what our identity is. What's next in terms of the captain's run tomorrow, game Saturday?
Captain's run tomorrow, game Saturday. And then, as I was saying earlier on, I have a 7 a.m. flight penciled in for Sunday morning to get up to Tokyo nice and early because I wanted to go watch Scotland against Japan, see the moments where the hopes are either dashed or made for the home nation. So hopefully that flight happens and hopefully that game happens. I'd be very surprised if I do manage to get on that plane. I'd be very surprised if I do manage to make it to Yokohama on Sunday. But it does seem that the organisers are confident that there is hope for the game itself. Could be late put on. But obviously we had Gregor Townsend speaking there in the last couple of hours as well. And he reckons that there's a possibility that the game could be played behind closed doors on Sunday night, which would be an interesting prospect. That would actually be a very intriguing atmosphere. And yeah, having been in Shizuoka, like, that's a big boost for Scotland. That is almost the ideal situation for Scotland. Behind closed doors, Sunday night, because the weather's going to be crappy. There's going to be no fans. And, like, I know Scotland played a decent brand of rugby for a Six Nations side, I guess. But they'd still prefer, they'd thrive more in a bad day than Japan would. Now, the irony in saying that is that they got smashed by Ireland when it was lashing rain in Yokohama a couple of weeks back.
Excuse my ignorance. Does that stadium have a roof on it? Would that be dry conditions, or would that be in the elements?
No, there's only three stadiums here that have roofs. It's Kobe, you've got Oita, and then you've got the Sapporo Dome as well. So maybe that's one of the reasons why Oita has been mentioned in kind of breath of hosting all quarterfinals, because it does have that roof, and the conditions of the game at least aren't going to be affected. So it's a perfect behind closed doors facility, whereas Yokohama really is not.
Is the forecast for the quarterfinals bad?
We don't know yet. Like, I mean, this typhoon goes. Like, it was only really Monday when we started to realize this typhoon was coming. If there's another thing coming from the South Pacific, we won't know until the end of this weekend. But no, there's no suggestion yet that there is going to be any horrible, horrible weather. It's just a remnant of this thing, Jer. It's just a remnant of a typhoon, what it can do on a place and what it can do logistically for a tournament. It's not great. Like, I mean, looking at all the different Category 5 hurricanes, you get lost in a YouTube wormhole of destruction. It's like world's most amazing videos on loop on YouTube. It's a terrible, terrible stuff. It's like, I don't know whether to be kind of intrigued by this, because it really is, you're kind of fearful for kind of the well-being of people who are going to be in Yokohama, who are actually out stewarding this tournament this weekend. So whatever that leaves in its wake, whatever that does for the facilities around the country, then it could have an impact on the World Cup quarterfinal. You would imagine, though, surely World Rugby are now sitting down saying, okay, what is our plan B now? What happens if there does happen to be another typhoon? At least let's save some face. In fact, another typhoon would be good for us, because then we can make up for the previous typhoon and actually do a better job at this typhoon or something like that. So hopefully it'll all be okay. And hopefully, if Japan-Scotland goes ahead this Sunday and these typhoons pass through the country without anybody getting hurt, World Rugby will be breathing a sigh of relief. Japan-Scotland is the key one. That is the one that really reflects on the integrity of the competition. It's bad enough, all right, if we have to go up against the rest of New Zealand, but we'll get over it. But having to settle for a second spot because Japan got a week off, I don't think that's good enough, to be quite honest.
Owen, good stuff. Thanks a million.
Good stuff, lads.
Sorry, one last second. How's your hand?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, it's okay. There is Gavin from the BBC had terrible, terrible reaction to mosquito bites a couple of weeks ago, where he had got huge lumps all along his arm. He had huge lumps all along his leg where his skin was peeling. He had plasters on that were pulling skin with it when the doctors went in. So he's been through the war, and he gave me a little bit of his steroid slash antibiotic gel. So I rubbed that on the hand, and hopefully that'll do the trick. It's not getting any bigger. The hand is not getting any bigger, so... I'm hopeful that we've ridden through the worst of
the storm. Give us a look.
Sorry, you're going to need the two hands.
Okay, it's still pretty bad.
It's okay, it's grand. I'll be absolutely fine.
Get us the name of that cream, and we'll send some Effie and get you deal with them.
Yeah, it's like Peyton Manning does Budweiser, I'll do 4,200 Japanese steroid spray. That's my thing. That's my first big sporting endorsement.
There you go. Oh, good stuff. Thanks a million.
Good luck.
9:27. Phil, welcome back.
Yeah, good to be back. We obviously know the draw for the Munster Hurling Championship next summer, but the fixtures have been released in terms of the schedules. And interesting enough, the first weekend is the 9th and 10th of May. So All-Ireland champions Tipperary will start with a match away to Waterford. Limerick are the reigning Munster champions. They'll start off at home to Cork, and then Clare will begin their season in the second round of fixtures at home to Tip. But so you have games on the 9th, 10th of May, then the following weekend, then they take a break, but then you've got the run of three weekends in a row. And just looking at it, Clare and Cork are the only two counties that are going to have to play those 3 weeks in a row.
Right.
They actually have a game against each other sandwiched in between the three. But yeah, that's kind of... Unfortunately, with five teams, two teams are going to get
three
in a row. And that's going to be Clare and Cork. And obviously the news from Clare is we still don't know who their manager is going to be. We thought we'd get that at the county board meeting last night, but the deadline for an appointment has been delayed until the 21st of October to allow the recruitment process to remain open. Another bit of news from GAA, Aoife Fitzgerald. Remember after Cork Ladies lost to Dublin in the All-Ireland semi-final in August, he said maybe it's time for a new voice. He's back. He's done a U-turn on his decision to step down. The Nemo Rangers clubman was ratified by the Cork LGFA Executive Committee last night on a 2-year term. Now, it's subject to further ratification at an upcoming county board meeting. But yeah, he had stepped down after 4 years in charge following that defeat to Dublin in August. So a U-turn there for Aoife Fitzgerald. Big night for the Republic of Ireland under-21s. They take on Italy at Tala Stadium, looking to make it 4 wins from 4 in Group 1 under Stephen Kenny. Kick-off is 8:05. And hopefully we don't get a repeat of what happened in Tala the other night, where we see a load of empty seats, because we're told it's sold out. There's people asking me for tickets and they want to go. I was like, I don't have any. I know my brother wanted to go, and he was like, well, if you didn't apply through the season ticket, you're not going to get your chance. So I hope it's not a case of what happened the other night.
It looks like a good team.
Yeah, obviously Aaron Connolly's gone, but you know, Troy Parrott, who actually, I mean, we do forget that Troy Parrott didn't start the Sweden game.
No, and Obafemi's not going to start this game, it looks like, according to John Fallon, has a probable team.
Yeah, I'm still just a little bit concerned about his hamstrings. It's something that Ralph Hasenhüttl said last season.
Well, he's going to have to work very hard, and it's up to him to like to put in the hard yards now to make sure that the hamstrings aren't an issue. But he's been playing well when he's been coming off the bench and played well in the League Cup.
Yeah, he set up that one for Danny Ings with a lovely ball, great vision against Portsmouth. So, you know, would be good to see him in there. But Adam Ida is a player that looks like he's got a decent future in the game as well.
Yeah.
No, they're just a great team to watch. They play a certain way, and this would be a good test for them. And you know, it's incredible to think we've never qualified for an under 21 European Championship. So, what a story that would be if Stephen Kenny gets us there, and then he comes in, takes over the senior team.
Well, there's three games left, isn't there?
Yeah. So, what does he do there then? Does he say to Keith Andrews, here, you have a go?
Keith Andrews?
Yeah.
Yeah, totally. Absolutely.
He's part of the management team.
Exactly. That'll make the most sense.
Yeah, you guys have been here with me. Just see out the last few games.
Yeah. Feel good stuff? You finished?
Just one thing to watch out for today. Christina Desmond and Amy Broadhurst, both in quarterfinal action at the Women's World Elite Boxing Championships in Siberia. So if they win today, they guarantee medals. Broadhurst has the tougher fight. She's against Mira Pockin and the Finn that seems to make a habit of beating Irish boxers.
Good stuff. Unfortunately. Right, 9:31 this morning. That's it from us. If you missed anything from the show, sports page is Keith Wood, Kieran McGinn. You can catch the podcast back on offtheball.com/podcasts or on the Go Loud app. You can check out our YouTube channel, subscribe there tonight on Off the Ball from 7 o'clock. John Giles, and of course, live commentary of the Republic of Ireland under 21s against Italy. We'll see you tomorrow morning on OTBAM from 7:30. Stephen Hunt's in studio, building up to Ireland against Samoa and Ireland against Georgia. It's a massive, massive weekend of sport for Ireland.
OTB AM.